Next chapter. Title: Olan. Maggie requested that the helicopter return the next day to the same location to pick her up. Finding herself in the middle of a charred and cleared landscape that was once a jungle, Maggie decided to plod along until she found whatever remained of it. Half a day's travel later, she noticed a moving figure in the distance, just below the horizon. She dropped to her knees, trying to meld into the surrounding mud and slash in case the figure was a harbinger of danger. The figure was moving in her direction, and as it came closer, it turned out to be a young girl of about 6 years of age. She was dark-skinned with straight black hair and a round face. Maggie stood up and waved to the girl, who then waved back. When they met, Maggie noticed a string of rusty iron beads hanging around her neck and a tattoo under her lower lip. Maggie asked for her name, and she answered back with tears streaming down her cheeks, "Olan of the Bantula tribe." Maggie recognized that tribe as one that lived in the same jungle area as her Obongomio tribe. "What happened to make you wander in this barren land?" asked Maggie. Olan answered, "All the women, including Mama and me, were taken away in big Wazongo beasts, and 2 days ago the loggers said I was too young and left me here and took Mama away." Maggie took her into her bosom, trying to console her. "Have you had anything to drink or eat today, Olan?" She shook her head to the negative. The clouds were gathering, and a downpour would ensue, so Maggie decided to stay put with Olan. As the rain started, she held out a folding cup she had in her pocket, and they both drank. They then huddled together until the rain subsided. They started back where the helicopter would land the next day. They pulled whatever plant material was left on the ground to create a makeshift rickety hut and stayed there that evening. In the morning, the helicopter landed, and at first the pilot would not take Olan on board, using the excuse they had not expected the extra weight and did not have enough fuel to make it back with her on board. But Maggie begged him, and finally he complied. Olan was terrified of this flying thing and would not approach it until Maggie got on and motioned for her to climb on. Olan did so reluctantly. When they arrived at the Castalia airport, Maggie called Ismail to help her get Olan back to the USA. He arrived a week later and told Maggie to say Olan is her daughter to help with the issuing of a passport for the both of them. It took another 3 weeks in Brasilia to have a new passport issued for them both. Next chapter. Title: Eugene. Olan was having a hard time adjusting. She hung on to Maggie's arm the whole time. Everyone outside her tribe was considered a potential enemy. Since she was only 6 years old, in a completely foreign environment with different smells, lighting, sounds, and languages, she felt she needed protection and reassurance. Olan was taken up to her room in what was called the River House, and she stayed there for about a week simply because she was too frightened. She wouldn't even go down to eat with Maggie. On the second day, Maggie took a meat and potato dish enough for two up to her room, sat on the floor, and started to eat. She encouraged Olan to do the same. More often than not, she would spit or vomit it up again. After 2 days, Maggie went to the grocery store and bought vegetables, nuts, berries, and mushrooms that she thought Olan might be able to keep down. She also visited a local chicken farm and bought some. At the River House, she prepared a chicken the way they did in the wild by roasting it whole, less the innards, until the feathers and skin were pretty much gone, filling the kitchen with the smell of burnt feathers. These ingredients and cooking methods turned out more palatable to Olan. She even felt better and slept on top of the bed instead of in the closet during the night. Olan gathered a few chicken bones and buried them under the bed as she sang the Olamadi song. In the second week, she was introduced to the clothing that Olan needed to wear to be civil around the house. Maggie started with a pair of shorts that bothered her at first, but eventually got used to them. Next came sandals, and eventually a t-shirt. Now, Olan spent most of her nights singing the songs she sang with her tribe back in the Amazon jungle. Sometimes they got to be loud, waking Maggie up in alarm as she reached for the light switch. One morning, as Maggie was having breakfast, she noticed Olan coming down the stairs taking slow steps. It seemed she was venturing around the River House. "Come, Olan," yelled Maggie, but Olan didn't understand those words. Maggie then spoke up and said, "Olan, come to me," and motioned with her hand for her to approach her. As she fought with her crotch, Olan walked up to Maggie and said, "Saba el Kir," which was her tribal morning greeting. As Olan became more familiar with the river house, she one day asked Maggie what the big white box was for in the kitchen. It turned out to be the refrigerator, and Maggie opened it up and showed her all the food and drink that was in it. "Why does it not stink?" Olan asked. "It is because it is a cold box, and cold food does not spoil," she said as she placed Olan's hand on one of the refrigerator shelves. Olan pulled it away quickly. She had never experienced a cold before. "But why do you have a cold box in the kitchen?" Olan inquired. "So we don't have to go hunting," answered Maggie. "No hunting? How do you get food then?" she probed. "We no longer hunt for food, but we possess plants and animals that we grow and eat," she responded. "What is the word possess?" Olan queried. Maggie retorted, "It is hard to explain. It is like your bow and arrows you had to leave at the airport. They are things that you call your own." "How can you call an animal your own when it belongs to Gaba?" she asked. Maggie responded, "Here in Oregon, we own our animals and they do not belong to the forest." "So who do you give thanks to for the animal you kill and eat?" Olan asked. "Here in Eugene, we give thanks to God, for he has given us the animals and plants to do with as we please. We trade, take care of them, and we eat them." Olan fell silent and looked down at the floor. That night, Olan didn't feel right. She felt that Maggie was doing something wrong by eating and not giving thanks to Gaba, which Olan had been doing during her singing. So, she decided to teach Maggie the Gaba thank you song the next morning. As she started to sing, Maggie immediately stood up and went over to Olan to console her and explain that we couldn't sing when food was being served. Olan started to feel threatened and ran up to her room, hid in the closet, and would not come out for 2 days. Maggie brought out the vacuum cleaner and started to clean Olan's room. As she pushed the vacuum nozzle under the bed, the hose started to shake, and the vacuum went clank, clank, and stopped. She opened the filter canister and found a few jammed chicken bones. Olan, at the time, was in the bathroom across the hall, so she went and got her explaining that she should not place the chicken bones under the bed. "But how do chickens come back every day to be eaten if I don't bury their bones and sing the Olamati song?" she asked. "You don't have to bury chicken bones here in Oregon to eat chicken every day, nor sing the Olamati song," she responded. "Why?" she inquired. Maggie grabbed her hand and took her out of her room, down the stairs through the front door, to the chicken pen in the back of the river house, and said, "Here, you see, we have many chickens for you to eat." "Where did they come from?" Olan asked. "I bought them from a local chicken farmer," she replied. "Where did the chicken farmer get them from?" Olan asked. "I don't know exactly," Maggie replied. "I suppose she breeds them or buys them from somewhere. It's complicated," she added. "I know where they came from," Olan said. "Where, Olan?" Maggie asked. "From Gaba," she replied. "Yes, Olan, from the jungle," Maggie replied as she gave in. The river house was situated on 25 acres of land, which made Olan uncomfortable. "Where are the trees?" Olan asked. "Oh, they were all cut down a long time ago," Maggie responded. "Where then is your livelihood?" "It's, right here in the river house." "How can you have a livelihood without trees?" she exclaimed. Maggie scratched her head and said, "It is complicated." Olan looked around and noticed a bug-like thing flying slowly behind Maggie. She pointed at it and asked, "What kind of a hashara is that, Maggie?" Maggie looked behind her, couldn't see a bug, but did notice a tractor going down the road, and realized that because of Olan's lack of depth perception, she mistook it for something much smaller and closer. "That is called a tractor, Olan. It is used to plow the fields you see over there and plant hay for the cattle." She pointed to the large expanse of open space beyond the tractor. Olan felt sick all of a sudden and ran to the river house. Maggie followed Olan in and found her in her room, sitting on her bed, so Maggie sat beside her. Olan was looking out the window when a truck passed by on the road, and she asked, "What does that thing do?" "It digs water wells." "What is a water well?" asked Olan. "It is how we get water from the ground," responded Maggie. "Why do you have to dig for water?" exclaimed Olan. Well, we have no rivers or creeks running near the river house to water the 25 acres, so we have to get the water from the ground. Can't you get water from the rain? Inquired Olan. Yes, we can, but it is not enough to handle all the water needs. In the jungle, we never had to do anything about water except drink it, responded Olan. Why was there smoke coming out of the tractor? Asked Olan. Well, for the tractor to do anything, it has to burn fuel. What is fuel? Asked Olan. Maggie thought for a moment, then said, It is like water, except it's smelly and isn't water. Where do you get this smelly fuel? Olan asked. We get it from the ground, returned Maggie. She then realized what she had just done. She just said that both water and fuel come from the ground, and she pondered how to explain that and said, It's complicated. Maggie had gotten a job as a lecturer at Lane Community College on 30th Avenue in the interdisciplinary subject of sociobiology. A year later, Olan was signed up for an English as a second language class at the same college. 6 years later, teenage Olan learned to communicate well using her newfound language and was now in a special needs school run by Catholic nuns. It was touted as a premier school with the highest graduation rate in the state of Oregon. For the first few years, she was pushed up a grade and then another, so she would be with children of her same age. Unfortunately, she was feeling controlled and unable to do the things she used to do back in the jungle. Music was a big part of the tribe's life, and Olan was known to have a beautiful singing voice. Gone were the days of resonating around the campfire and the telling of stories old and new. Gone were the days of reenacting the legends of the origins. Gone were the days of dancing in unison with the rest of the children. Evenings were now occupied by homework, never-ending chores, and sitting still and watching others play imaginary skits on the television. This feeling was starting to manifest itself in rebellion. Her grades started to slide, and she was paying less attention to the everyday chores around the house. One day, Olan shouted, Shit! I never had to do any of this crap with my family back in the jungle, as she threw the toilet brush out the bathroom door. Maggie quickly rushed into the bathroom, asking what was the matter. Olan was on the floor, leaning against the toilet, crying. Maggie consulted with family therapist Max Reed about this problem, and he advised her to find a way to make sense of the transition in Olan's life. In other words, Maggie had to do something to bridge the gap between Olan's former life and what it has become in this civilized land. Maggie and Olan decided there would be less television and more discussions with Max Reed on why Olan is feeling that way, and they set up sessions with Max twice a week. In their first session, Max asked Olan how she was feeling. She said, Okay, I guess. Your mom said you were not feeling like you had any freedom. She said you felt kind of confined doing chores, that you didn't know why you were doing them, said Max. Olan was silent. What chore do you like the least? He asked. Any of them, I guess, she replied. Your mom said you had an episode when you were cleaning the toilet. Is that true? He asked. Yeah, she responded. What happened? He asked. I got tired of cleaning. Don't you want the bathroom to be clean and tidy? He asked. I never had to do anything like that when I was with my family back in Brazil, she asserted. Did someone else clean the toilet back in Brazil? He asked. There were no freaking toilets back there. How and where did you defecate then? We just squatted and left it, she said. Ew, exclaimed Max. Maggie then interrupted the conversation by saying, You see, Max, the population density of the Amazon jungle where Olan was from was around one person for every square mile of jungle. The chances of running across where you made your last deposit were extremely slim. You see, the jungle has its way of dealing with such matters. There are bugs, insects, and other species that consume what we leave behind. So in a matter of a day, it is all gone. That is hard to believe, Max countered. I know if you leave the toilet unflushed, the crap does not disappear in a day or two or three, but starts to stink. Please tell me why that is. Maggie explained that in our civilized world, we use insecticides and other poisons to kill off insects and other species. So therefore, our remains in the toilet are worked on by slow bacteria that produce the bad smells he was talking about. Maggie continued to explain that the population density of civilization is around 130 individuals per square mile, so you have 130 times the quantity of shit piling up beyond any insect or other species' ability to take care of it. That is not here nor there, Max replied. I am talking about general cleanliness and proper hygiene of the here and now. We are not out in the jungle, and therefore we need to be extra vigilant about such matters. That is exactly right. Olan is complaining about this extra effort and can't see the reason for it. I hope our discussion helps in this matter, added Maggie. Then she turned to Olan and asked, Do you see why we have to exert an extra effort? Olan answered, I still don't understand why there is so much crap around that is not being taken care of here, like back home in the jungle. Max added, You know, if you figure out a way to make taking care of the chores in the bathroom 130 times faster, you would be a millionaire. Next chapter. Title, The Imbeciles. After Maggie returned home from college, fixed dinner, and washed the dishes, she decided to take a shower to get ready for her date with a gentleman caller. When she was done with the shower, and was wiping herself off with a towel, Olan walked in on her by mistake, realizing she was not supposed to do that, so she walked out quickly and shut the door. Nothing was said about the incident in the bathroom that night, and Maggie had a good time out with her new friend. The next day, when Maggie returned home from work, she inquired why Olan suddenly exited the bathroom the night before. And Olan said that it was not customary in civilized settings to barge in on anybody naked and see their exposed imbeciles. Maggie laughed out loud and asked, What are imbeciles? Olan replied, The perky part of the breast. Next chapter. Title, The Diseases. In the second session with Max Reed, they picked up on the subject matter of the previous session, namely cleaning the bathroom. Max introduced the subject of disease and personal hygiene by saying, We talked about cleanliness in the bathroom, and I would like to introduce another reason why it is important, and that is the spreading of bacteria and viruses that make us sick. You see, we need to keep such places free of these bugs to maintain healthy bodies and minds. You see, viruses spread the common cold and bacteria spread dysentery and other ailments. If we do not keep our houses free of these germs, we will not be able to perform our jobs or go to school, Max added. We also don't want to let insects and other such types of species into our homes because they are carriers of diseases too. I will have to admit that it is not the most efficient way to deal with germs like in the jungle. But the little struggles we take to keep the bathroom clean are well worth the effort because they allow us to enjoy the prosperous civilizations we build. Olan countered. The struggles are not little. I have to clean the bathroom every other day when I could be playing with my friends. Maggie added, You don't understand, Max. The civilizations we build accumulate and spread disease instead of eliminating them. The Centers for Disease Control counts approximately 80 communicable diseases in the United States population that rarely exist in the jungles of the Amazon basin among the indigenous tribes that are rarely, if ever, contacted. As a matter of fact, the indigenous tribes suffer greatly from close proximity to civilized humans because civilized humans are carriers of disease. And whenever the tribes come in contact, approximately 50% of the tribe's people die. So, to the indigenous people, we are like the insects and other species that carry the diseases, Maggie explains. Max tried to counter Maggie's explanation by saying, But civilized humans invented medicine that takes care of these diseases, and there are countless studies that prove that we have conquered many, if not all, 80 diseases by prevention, inoculations, and treatment methods. You can't tell me that we are not healthier than the jungle people. One example of this proof is that we live longer than the tribal people, and that is a fact. The efforts we take to fight disease are well worth it. Maggie countered by saying, The efforts we take to counter disease are huge. Billions of dollars are spent every year to combat them. Whole industries are built around the concentration of these 80 diseases. That is the reason why you defend the current level of diseases in our communities. If you try to talk against the health industry, you will be the laughingstock of everyone. Isn't that right? I hate cleaning toilets, and I don't understand what this conversation is about, shouted Olan. Next chapter. Title. Chanty. Maggie and Olan had neighbors to the north named the Olsons. They had a son, about the same age as Olan, named Chanty, who adored her. But Olan wanted nothing of him. He was always trying to kiss her when they were out in the yard or her room. At one point, she refused to play with him. One time, she was playing with her collection of plastic farm animals and pretended to be a farmer. Mrs. Olson brought Chanty over to be watched by Maggie while she went out shopping. Olan would not let Chanty into her room to play. So, Chanty went complaining to Maggie. Maggie called Olan to the living room and insisted she let Chanty play with her, and after a long argument, Olan agreed. As Olan and Chanty were walking to Olan's room, Maggie could hear Olan telling Chanty, "You can play my dead husband." Next chapter. Title: Population Balance. In the third session with Max Reed, Maggie tried to pinpoint the need for disease in overpopulated civilized areas of the world by saying, "Olan has to clean the toilet because of overpopulation in civilized areas of the world to fight disease along with the health industry." If we look at both populations side by side, we find that the main difference is the population density. In the jungles of the Amazon basin, the population density is 1 person per square mile of jungle, while in civilized areas, the population count rises to 130 persons per square mile of cleared land. We must ask the question, why don't the indigenous people grow in number to reach 130 individuals per square mile? The answer is that, among other factors, communicable diseases will start to creep into the population, causing it to decrease in number and return to 1 person per square mile again, since they don't have a health industry. In a natural setting, there are many factors that influence the size of a population, and disease is one of them. In a civilized world, natural ways of controlling populations are not condoned or practiced, and it is preferred that artificial ways of governmental and health industry control be adapted. What I feel Olan is trying to do is ask the question whether it is better to be civilized and spend a lot of time cleaning, disease prevention, and treatment, or to be natural and let nature take its course. "Is that right, Olan?" Maggie asked. "I just don't understand why I do all the things I do, from cleaning toilets to studying to going to school for 6 hours a day and coming home just to do homework for another 2 hours. I don't understand why we need to go to the supermarket every week to buy food when it's provided at any time and anywhere back in the jungle. I didn't have to go to school or have homework, but spent my time playing with my siblings and friends," Olan said. Max interjected, "Hold on there. All the schooling that we do, it adds up to 12, 16, sometimes 20 years, is because the level, quantity, and quality of knowledge is much higher than that in the jungle, where you don't care about advancement. And it isn't that we don't appreciate nature. We spend a lot of time and money trying to understand it so we can benefit from it." Maggie countered and said, "But we are driven away from nature with all the knowledge we have. The more we ask questions about nature, the farther away we find ourselves from it. Why is that? We build rockets to escape our nature on Earth to go somewhere else. Why is that?" Olan is asking, what is the use of all the knowledge we are acquiring if it leads us away from the obvious ways of nature? Max said, "Why are you driving a wedge between nature and modern civilization when we are trying to convince Olan of a bridge that she can cross from her old way of life to the modern one?" Maggie replied, "I guess the more we talk about it, the more I am having a hard time seeing such a bridge. I think I need to take a break and try to collect my thoughts on where this conversation is going." Next chapter. Title: The Snaps. Terry, Cynthia, and Andrea were invited to a sleepover at Olan's house. There wasn't enough room for all four of them to sleep in Olan's room, so they decided to sleep in the living room, which opened up to the kitchen where Maggie had cooked a new batch of gingersnap cookies. Maggie explained the cookies were for school lunches the next day, so they were off limits to the girls that evening. In the middle of the night, Olan got up quietly and tiptoed over to the kitchen to snack on the gingersnaps. As she was stuffing her mouth, Cynthia woke up and saw what she was doing. "You aren't supposed to eat those cookies, Olan," she said. Olan looked surprised that Cynthia was awake and said, "You are just dreaming. Go back to sleep." Next chapter. Title: Nature. In the fourth session with Max Reed, he said, "Let's talk about longevity, and maybe this will bridge the gap between where Olan sees herself in the here and now and her former life. It is a fact that longevity in the civilized world is much longer than in the jungles of the Amazon River basin. For example, in the jungle, the life expectancy is 45 years, while in the civilized world, it is 70 and 80 years. I think this is a huge benefit of civilization, don't you, Olan?"
"I guess so," replied Olan. "Hold on a second," Maggie butted in on the conversation.
"Even life expectancy is under the control of nature in the Amazon River basin. Stability is nature's game. When a tribe of hunter-gatherers consisting of 20 individuals lives in a jungle, the tribe needs to stay at 20 individuals to strike a balance with the environment. So, if three babies are born, then eventually three adult tribe members need to die of old age to maintain the 20-individual level. If this does not happen, and the tribe grows in number beyond 20 individuals, this will cause the jungle to be overburdened and eventually be consumed. This is a completely different paradigm than that of civilization. On the one hand, civilization seems to tell us to wish for anything to make us happy, and don't mind what happens to the environment, because science will eventually make it better. On the other hand, nature is telling us to think in terms that humans are an integral part of the environment, no better or worse than any other part of it. Nature seemed to have dictated the optimum population size for the humans on planet Earth. It is around 0.5 to 1.5 individuals per square mile, depending on the capacity of the environment to maintain itself. Nature has several ways of maintaining this density, one of which we have already discussed, and that is communicable disease. As a population increases in density, diseases start to increase among its individuals, and it decreases the density once again. Silence came over the three of them for about 30 seconds, and Max then said, "I guess what you are saying is that Olan has to choose between nature and science."
"I guess you are right," Maggie responded. "But don't forget that inquisitiveness is what identified the two paradigms, and I think inquisitiveness has some sort of place in Olan's decision. So it is a situation where Olan needs to select between a blind science on one hand and a selfless inquisitive science that has the well-being of the Earth as an overriding factor." Next chapter. Title: Play, Play, Play. Maggie explained to Olan that to guard against crimes such as kidnapping, she should yell out loud, "She is not my mother," if a woman was grabbing her, or "He is not my father," if a man was trying to grab her. One day Maggie took Olan and her friends to Alton Baker Park for some fresh air and sunshine. When it was time to go home, Olan refused to go because she was having a lot of fun. Maggie pleaded with her several times, but Olan would not listen. Finally, when Maggie grabbed her by the arm and tried to pull her towards the car, Olan yelled, "She is not my mom!" And a crowd gathered to see what was going on. One of them called 911. Maggie had a terrible time convincing the police that Olan was her daughter. Next chapter. Title: Planet Earth. In the fifth session, Max Reed asked Olan, "Last time we discussed the dilemma of choosing nature or science as your guide to the bridge that paves the way to help you cope with everyday life here. On the one hand, we have civilization supported by science, and we have the old way of nature being the overriding factor. Have we been helping you in this endeavor?"
"No, not really," Olan replied. "On the one hand, Maggie has been taking the nature stand while you have been taking the civilized stand. I have to admit, Maggie's position is more to my liking, so I will have to choose nature as my guide." Max felt defeated at this point, because the outcome of their session so far has not changed Olan's mind, nor has it helped her build a bridge to the civilized side of the argument. He feels he has to be a little more aggressive in promoting the civilized here and now over the way she was living before. "How did you get here to Oregon from Brazil?" he asked her.
"By machines like the helicopter, the planes, and the cars we had to take," she replied.
"And why did you have to leave the Amazon jungle behind?" he asked her.
because it was not there anymore.
I was taken away from my mommy and Maggie found me, replied Olan as tears started to roll down her cheeks.
You see, Olan, when it comes to the jungle against civilization, there is only one victor.
It is civilization, he said.
Do you want to be on the losing side or the winning one?
There was then a moment of silence in the room.
I don't care, shouted Olan. I am not going to follow anything you say or tell me to do.
She bolted out of the room as Maggie and Max looked at each other in wonderment.
Why did you bring competition into the situation? Asked Maggie.
We were getting nowhere the way the conversation was going, and I felt I had to push a little, responded Max.
Maggie rushed out of the room after Olan and found her outside the building sitting on a bench next to the front door.
I am sorry, honey, for the way the conversation went. Come back with me and I will try to get it back on track again, said Maggie.
After returning to Max's office and sitting down, Maggie said,
It is not a matter of who is winning today or not. It is a matter of what is right for the planet Earth. Today, civilization seems to be winning the battles, but will it eventually win the war? We need to look past the battles and wars to what is appropriate and correct.
I will have to agree that the jury is out as far as who will win the war, but I must say that civilization seems to have the upper hand.
Another angle we can explore is that of providing food for humankind. As you said, civilization has a population density of 130 individuals per square mile, and if we try to feed those people with what can be produced in a jungle, they will all die out. We have to consider the ingenuity of civilization in figuring out a way of feeding all those people, Max said.
Maggie disagreed by saying, You are missing the whole point. It takes a lot of non-renewable energy to produce that food.
Not only that, but sequestering the land for agriculture drives off its natural populations, replacing them with resources suitable for only humans. We are losing precious species every day to extinction because of it.
Where is the good in that?
Under nature, there is a two-way relationship between food and its consumer. As the number of consumers increases, they deplete the food supply, and that in turn causes a decrease in the number of consumers. For example, another tool at the disposal of nature is the predator-prey relationship. As the predator population increases, the prey population decreases, and in turn decreasing the predator population when they can't find enough to eat. Modern humans are hoarders, and when anything threatens their hoarded wealth, they do battle to maintain it. So, when a herd of cattle is culled by a puma, the puma pays the price, which goes against the wisdom of nature. Shelter is also a tool of nature to control the balance between populations in an environment like a forest and its inhabitants. As the raw materials for building a shelter decrease, less shelter is provided, and an increase in the exposure to the elements causes a decrease in the population using the raw materials. To return to the subject of life expectancy, it is under the control of nature. Stability is nature's game. When a tribe of hunter-gatherers consisting of 30 individuals lives in a jungle, the tribe needs to stay at 30 individuals to strike a balance with the environment. So, if 5 babies are born, then eventually 5 adult tribe members need to die of old age or other means to maintain the 30. If this does not happen and the tribe grows in number, this will cause the jungle to be overburdened and eventually be consumed.
That's all the time we have today. I am concerned that Olan has not been participating in our discussions, so I think we need to take a week off and have her explore what Maggie and I have been talking about and explain to us in the following week what she decides. Can we all agree to that? Maggie said.
I would agree to that.
Next chapter. Title: Creativity. In the 6th session with Max Reed, Max asked Olan if she thought about what the previous sessions were about.
Olan had prepared several handwritten pages that she started to read from.
Before the advent of humans, most life forms depended on the rays of the sun as a source of energy for billions of years. It was the right amount of energy to create and maintain the rhythm of life's musical symphony. Even the earliest humans did so. But then human ingenuity discovered an alternative source of seemingly endless energy, which was used to create a sound that did not fit with the original symphony. Villages, towns, cities, and states that now cover Earth were built with this energy. Rivers were redirected, the ground was disfigured, and oceans were depleted to make room for the growing human population that eventually marred Earth to the point where humans couldn't hear the original symphony anymore. This new modern sound is a cacophony drowning out the original opus, which now can only be heard by a few researchers looking for the kernel of truth to life's nature. Meanwhile, the rest of humanity is reveling in its noise, proclaiming it is the hum of the universe. So the curved line was replaced with the straight one, greenery was replaced by gray, chlorophyll was replaced by dioxins, and death was cheated out of its duties. Instead of eliminating the sour notes, modern humanity has bandaged them and made them part of the wine of its cosmos. This modern-day world has very little resemblance to the real one, and as a result, is fragile because it carries a heavy load of bitter tones that don't jive with the original. Death is revered in the genuine world while scorned in that of modern humans. It is the quality control that makes sure no acrid notes are played during that life's performance. It is the teacher who makes sure life's symphony is flawless. It is the conductor who guides every life performer to play to the satisfaction of the primary universe. Nature loves harmony, balance, and symphony. Anything that comes between nature and its beloved activities is eventually eliminated. For modern humans, to do battle with nature is futile. The result will be their elimination if they don't heed and quit singing out of tune.
"Wow," exclaimed Max. "You must have studied for this essay. You have done a wonderful job and are so poetic. I also see you leaning towards nature and not civilization. That means we have failed so far to bridge the gap between the two. Olan, your world does not exist anymore, and you need to engage what is here in order to survive," Maggie added. Olan abruptly stood up and said, "I don't care about what you two have been talking about. I will not do anything you two suggest or insist I do to fit into your stinking world." She then ran out of the room. Maggie ran after her, and they met up at the car. Olan now had her earbuds on, trying to ignore Maggie, who unlocked the car. They both got in, and Maggie drove off. Next chapter. Title: Trouble. Olan thought she knew everything and did not take advice or orders from anyone. She quit going to the sessions with Maggie and Max Reed, and she started to date rough characters who came from broken homes and homes where much violence occurred daily. To say the least, she got into a lot of trouble with Maggie and could not wait until she could strike out on her own. Her boyfriend, Raoul, who came from a family where his father killed his mother and claimed it was an accident, persuaded her to open her legs to customers who would pay. Olan agreed, and would skip school to do so. At the end of the week, she would feel quite sore and use the weekends to recoup. Some customers were rough on her, demanding oral and anal sex, and when she would say no, they would physically force her. After a couple of weeks, she realized it was dangerous work and insisted that Raoul steal one of his father's Beretta handguns. After a while, Olan stopped going to school altogether, and Maggie was powerless to do anything about it. With Olan's steady job, Raoul was able to buy a Pontiac GTO and drive her to her appointments. When Olan turned 17 years of age, they decided to run away to Portland, where they thought business would be a lot more lucrative. They rented a house in the Milwaukee suburbs, and Raoul would drive her every evening to Old Town Portland and pick her up at dawn. Olan rented a room in the Rose City Motel on Stark Street, where she took her customers. One evening, Raoul got a call from her, but all he could hear was what sounded like a muffled, "Help me," and a lot of background noise. He jumped in his car and rushed down to the motel and found the door to the room had been ripped off its hinges. Olan was on the bed bleeding. "He took the Beretta," she said. Just then, two policemen entered the room. Officer Joyce conducted the investigation and found out Olan had been pistol-whipped by a customer named Rambolt, who was a well-known criminal. An all-points bulletin went out for his arrest. Olan was arrested for prostitution and sentenced to 3 months in juvenile detention. When they arrested Rambolt, he confessed to taking the Beretta from Olan, and she was charged with the possession of a stolen gun, and 6 months were added to her sentence. She was led into the juvenile detention facility in Salem, Oregon, shackled. After processing and being given the rules of conduct, she was taken to her cell.
Her rebellion boiled to the surface when she was ordered to the mess hall for dinner. She refused to go. She then took her mattress and shoved it up against the door to her cell to keep the orderlies out. That tactic backfired because the orderlies managed to get the cell door open and removed her mattress altogether, so she had to sleep on the metal of the bed. In the morning, she was led to the shower room to wash up, but ended up throwing the soap at the orderlies. She was taken back to her cell without breakfast. She was then assigned a special orderly named Big Bertha, who specialized in hard cases. Olan stayed in her room all day, was not called to lunch or dinner, and was given water to drink instead. The next morning, Big Bertha asked Olan if she was ready to shower and have breakfast with the rest of the population, and Olan nodded in the affirmative. But Big Bertha said, "I can't hear you. Are you ready to shower and have breakfast?" Olan replied, "Yes." But Big Bertha was not satisfied. "Yes, what?" inquired Big Bertha. Olan returned, "Yes, ma'am." "No, that isn't the way to answer to me. To you, I am boss. You got that?" Olan replied by saying, "Yes, boss." The rest of the day had no incidents from Olan, but when Big Bertha returned her to her cell, she responded, "Good night," with "Good night," and under her breath, "Bitch." Big Bertha did not take that lightly. She forcefully hit Olan on the back of the neck with the back of her hand, propelling her to the opposite wall. She said, "What did you say?" Olan said, "Nothing." Big Bertha said, "You had better have said nothing to me, or I will make your life a living hell, you whore." The next morning, Olan requested to meet the manager and told him that Big Bertha hit her the night before for no apparent reason. "Do you have any witnesses?" he asked. She said, "No." He indicated the case was closed and dismissed her. The next night, Olan repeated her, "Good night, bitch," and Big Bertha heard it that time. Big Bertha grabbed her by the hair and led her outside to the asphalt recreation area and told Olan to make herself comfortable because that was where she was spending the night. It was September, and the cold nights were becoming more frequent. Olan tried to meet with the manager the next morning to complain, but was unsuccessful. She behaved herself, and Big Bertha did not bother her all day. Olan started to make friends with other girls in her cell block. They informed her of how sadistic Big Bertha could be. There was one rumor that she stuck the handle of a broom up the ass of one of the misbehaving girls who ended up in the hospital. Olan inquired if Big Bertha was punished, and the girl said no witnesses came forward. Big Bertha was on Olan's case throughout the 9 months she was in juvenile, and Olan made it a rule never to cross the boss's path anymore. She was let out of juvenile on her 18th birthday and returned to Maggie with a different attitude as far as getting along in this alien civilized environment. Olan got her GED from Lane Community College. She enrolled there as a biology major and one day was invited to sit in on Maggie's lecture when she had some free time. Maggie started the class by reviewing the previous session. "Who can tell me when capitalism started in history?" Several hands were raised, and Maggie picked a young man named Lane to answer her question. "Capitalism started in the 1500s. "And what is the essence of capitalism?" young Lane said, "To make a profit by producing goods." Maggie then asked, "Who can tell me when capitalism took off and changed the face of the earth?" Hands were raised, and Maggie picked a young woman. "Yes, Julie." "It started in the 1800s when fossil fuels were discovered and made available. Technology brought on by competition in the capitalistic market system resulted in the exponential growth of Earth's population from approximately 800 million in 1700 AD to 7 billion today." "Very good, Julie," Maggie went on to say. "With the increase of population count is an increase in the consumption of resources extracted from the earth to the point that some are being depleted beyond economic value, such as critical minerals, as can be observed in the following table, for example. It is predicted that the population of the earth will plunge to about 2 billion or less from 9 billion in 30 to 100 years as a result of this overconsumption of earth's resources. The departure of the human capitalistic system, with its focus on profits in the pursuit of consumer needs and wants from Mother Nature's of energy conservation and resource recycling, has caused many unpleasant side effects that are ruining most, if not all, Earth's biological habitats. humans behave as if they are the most important being on Earth. With fossil fuel as a power source and this motivation, humans set out to control their own destiny and proceeded to tame the world. Instead of a cyclical existence, they felt comfortable with a straight line. So, they built square homes, towns, and cities. They denuded the jungle and built farms with machinery that could only go in one direction, and so farmland was divided into square or rectangular fields. Instead of being a part of the circular food chain, humans chose to be at the top of a food pyramid. If a creature was thought to be useful to human existence, it was domesticated or farmed. If it was not thought of as being useful to humans, it was ignored or eliminated. This feeling of superiority was not only a juxtaposition of plants and animals, but included humans who were deemed inferior to those who were powerful or had influence. Instead of being more efficient in the use of energy, humans became less so by huge infusions of fossil fuels. They built their monetary systems based on increasing the profit margins of companies and individuals by teaching the need for material goods and services and meeting the public's demand for them. Energy was no longer a precious resource, but a way to heat up economies that support material-based growing populations. Instead of being a part of the biota, they chose to be apart from it. Next chapter. Title: Thoughts of the Return. After Olan completed her 2 years at Lane Community College, she went on to the University of Oregon. 4 years later, she received a master's degree in genetics, where she worked on the Neanderthal Genome Project. After her graduation, thoughts of returning to the Brazilian jungle to find her family crowded her mind. She was 25 years of age now, and at the end of one phase in her life, and felt she was ready to embark on a new journey. A journey to find her true identity. A journey to heal the wounds she suffered so young in her life. Unfortunately, she had little knowledge of where to start. All she remembered was her mother, father, brother, and 2 older sisters. One evening, after they both returned home and were having dinner together, Olan asked, "Maggie, why haven't you gone back to find your daughter Nasmina?" Maggie dropped her fork as she was raising it to her mouth. The loss of Nasmina was a hard subject for her, and she was not expecting it. Maggie got up from the table and went to her room without a spoken word. Later that evening, she came out of her room and approached Olan, who had finished washing the dishes and was sitting on the couch watching TV in the living room. Maggie was in the process of sitting next to her when Olan apologized for bringing up such a tender issue. Maggie sat for a few moments, then muted the TV and said, "I often wondered why I didn't go back there, and all I could come up with was that I found you. You were in terrible shape and needed immediate attention." Maggie noticed a tear starting to roll down Olan's cheek and said, "Please don't feel guilty about that, Olan. Life at times takes us in directions we had not thought of, and it is nobody's fault. All I can say is that Mother Nature has its ways." They held each other in silence until bedtime. At breakfast the next morning, Olan explained to Maggie her plans to return to the Amazon jungle and find her family. Maggie offered to help financially with the cost of the trip and living expenses there if she needed it. Next chapter. Title: The Return. Not surprisingly, Olan walked out the door of the river house without any luggage or even a carry-on. The cab was waiting for her with the engine running. The trip to the Eugene airport took half an hour, and she arrived the usual 2 hours earlier than her commuter flight out to San Francisco, where she changed planes and took off to Brasilia, the capital of Brazil. From there, she was supposed to take a commuter plane to the city of Castalia, but was told that the Castalia airport was on strike. So she cashed in her ticket for the commuter plane and bought the train tickets instead. After exiting the airport, she took a taxi to the train station and got on the next train to Castalia. On the train ride, she noticed a lot of towns alongside the railroad tracks that looked more like shanty towns. These little towns consisted of 2 rows of houses with the street in the middle parallel to the railroad tracks. On top of the houses were mounds of plastic bags full of garbage. At first, Olan didn't understand why the plastic bags full of garbage were there. After thinking about it for a while, she realized the people of these towns were so poor they had little sanitation available. It is as if technology was faster in reaching these people than their ability to take care of its side effects. When she reached Castalia, she went shopping for some energy bars and other foodstuffs for her travels in the jungle. She took off early the next morning to the original crash site of Maggie's plane, where Maggie found her 19 years earlier that was now a barren landscape. Olan decided to walk west to where she could see some green mountains in the distance. The jungle was trying to reclaim itself, and many plant shoots were coming up from the ground, most of which died from the persistent hot sun soon after emerging. 2 days into her trek, she encountered a group of natives wearing long shirts working to clear brush and burning it, while a large African-looking man holding a rifle in his arms stood by. As soon as the African saw Olan, he pointed the gun at her and ordered her to come to him. As she approached, he commanded her to get down on her knees, and she asked, "Why?" He hit her on the side of the head with the butt of his gun, and she collapsed unconscious. When she came to that evening in a large hut, she was surrounded by natives who had placed a wet rag over her forehead. She tried to get up, but felt dizzy. One native woman pulled her down and told her to rest. The native woman's name was Katmano, and she explained that they were all from the Katumali tribe. Olan asked why they were not living in the jungle, and an old native man named Olmati said, "The beasts of Tongaluta came and started to eat our precious Omali. One by one, the majestic Omali trees were devoured. We decided to fight for Omali, but our arrows and spears were cursed by Tongaluta, and we were driven deeper into our territory. But the jinx of the Tongaluta was everywhere, and Omali was not able to provide our food, as it once did. We tried to make peace with the bloodthirsty Tongaluta beasts and their helpers, but its mere presence put the curse on our tribe, and many died of a strange and cruel sickness." Olan explained that was what had happened to her tribe, the Bantula, a long time ago, and that she was trying to reunite with them. Old man Olmati said he did not recognize that tribal name, and indicated that she would have a hard time leaving this encampment because she would be put to work and guarded by the African with, as he put it, the death stick. Olan stayed 6 days working in the hot sun, clearing and burning brush for her shelter and food. In the very early dawn of the seventh day, and hours before anybody would wake up, she snuck out of the hut she was in and crawled through the encampment until she was out of anybody's sight. She stood up and continued west toward the Green Mountains. 2 days and 4 rain deluges later, she walked into a thicket of greenery on the edge of a thriving jungle. As she walked, she took off her shoes and then her blouse. Next off was her bra, then her skirt. Finally, she took off her panties, tossed them, and entered into the mass of trees. She was not alone in her trek. Every one of her steps was being followed by hidden eyes in that rainforest. They were eyes suspicious of strangers coming into their territory. The dynamic of protecting a territory had changed from guarding against other tribes coming in, but now they had to consider the trespass of loggers. In Olan's case, they were doubly concerned because they saw her disrobe and they thought she was a logger in disguise. As she dug around and pulled on a tuber that she had learned in survival school contained water, an arrow hit the exposed part of the plant and she stopped. She stood up and looked around and could now see figures behind the foliage. She shouted, "I am a friend. I am a friend. My name is Olan, and I come from a tribe called the Bantula." Another arrow hit a nearby tree, and she decided to submit, laying prostrate on the ground in the customary way of the Bantula. This seemed to appease the watching eyes, and the figures behind the vegetation started to come forward. There were about 6 of them, and as they came upon Olan, the figures started to touch her face, arms, legs, and private parts as they spoke in a language she did not understand. She started to tense up. The figures then formed a circle around her and started a discussion among themselves on what to do with her. Finally, they decided she was young enough to be incorporated into their tribe. One of the figures, who was a woman, told Olan, "Uome Watali Maya," as she motioned for her to get up and follow her. Olan was led into a camp clearing consisting of a long permanent structure with a thatched roof, outside of which was a campfire. It was midday and women were busy preparing the daily meal as they sang and laughed. Olan was then told to go with one of the young girls to collect dry wood for the campfire for the night, and they did so in a matter of half an hour. The whole tribe of 15 individuals plus Olan sat and partook in the daily meal together, after which they rested in the large structure out of the rain that came down approximately an hour later. Around the campfire at night, they sang and acted out stories Olan didn't fully understand, but she went along humming when she could. One night they asked her to sing a song she knew. She did and impressed the tribe with her high-pitched but mellow voice. Olan learned the technique of building a shelter for herself and the types of food to gather from the jungle that were safe to eat. After 4 weeks, Olan managed to pick up enough of their language to find out they were the Ilongeti tribe and expressed her desire to go looking for her tribe and mother. They told her that based on the tattoo under her lower lip, a tribe with a similar marking lived 6 days' travel to the north. They told her she would have to go it on her own, for they had no one to spare from their tribe to accompany her. 3 days later, Olan took an ember from the fire pit and placed it in a banana leaf like she was taught to do, to keep it lit and protected from the rain. She then headed north. The Ilongeti tribesmen taught her how to keep traveling north by heading toward a mountain called Gabal Talib, which was distinguishable by its square black rock crown. The jungle was very thick with trees, so to see this Gabal Talib, she had to climb a tree until she could see the horizon. Olan grew tired on the fourth day and became a little less attentive to the fire ember, and it was extinguished by the downpour of the afternoon rain. That meant she could not cook any of her food, and she had no evening campfire for protection. 3 days later, she still had not encountered anybody, and she wondered if she ever would. On the eighth morning, as she was climbing a tree to check on Mount Gabal Talib, she slipped and fell about 10 feet to the ground and lost consciousness. When she came to, she was in a hut being tended to for her scratches and bruises by a young girl with a tattoo under her lower lip. "What's your name?" Olan asked the young girl in the Bantulo dialect. She answered, "Lamalo. What is yours?" Olan answered, "Olan, daughter of Molonga of the Bantula tribe." The young girl ran out yelling, "She is Bantuli! She is Bantuli!" Several heads appeared in the hut's opening and were then pushed aside by an elder tribesman who entered and sat next to Olan. "Welcome, Molonga's daughter. I am Tetlonga, Molonga's youngest brother." Fighting the pain of her fall, Olan reached out her arms and Tetlonga embraced her. Tetlonga was now the eldest of the tribe and considered the wisest. He made sure Olan was comfortable in her convalescence. A day later, Olan attended the nightly gathering around the campfire and learned that the tribe did not live in that part of the jungle when her mother was present. They were driven out of their original territory, east of where they currently were, after the Washanga battle with the yellow logging beasts of the Wazongos. Their arrows would just bounce off of the beasts, and the spears were not much better. Ombala, the bravest of their tribe, climbed on top of one of the beasts and tried to choke it, but its fire-breathing nose burned him and he fell to the ground and was trampled. After the tribe lost that battle, where 6 tribesmen were killed, the Wazongos took their women away, including her mother, Molonga, and her. "Where did they take us?" asked Olan. Tetlonga told her that the women were taken to the Wazongo camp to please the workers, and they never saw them again. Olan surmised the Wazongos had no use for a 5-year-old girl and left her on the side of a dirt road where she was rescued by Maggie 2 days later. After the Washanga battle, there were only 4 men left in the tribe. They decided to head west, deeper into the jungle, where they encountered the Kaloka tribe, who did not want them there, and so the Kalashanga battle was fought. In that battle, 8 Kaloka men died, and the 3 remaining fled deeper into the jungle. All that remained were the women and children whom the Bantulo took into their new tribal territory. Next chapter. Title: Nen. Home Again. The 9 rusty iron beads hanging around her neck symbolize the number of times Olan's mother gave birth, and Olan was number 9. All her elder sisters were taken away by the men who served the yellow beasts. All that was left were her brothers, 2 of whom died in that battle. The tribe let her stay in the camp while they went hunting during the morning for the first few days. After that, she would go out with them in the mornings, joining the women and girls in gathering the fruits, nuts, and mushrooms as they chased the game animals into the men's nets. The main source of meat was a Tuglusi capybara, which the men shot with a poisoned dart. Before the hunt in the morning, the women and girls would gather their equipment, which included baskets that they carried on their backs and digging sticks that they used to dig up tubers. The men and boys would make sure they had enough nets and darts as they made chants to the spirits of the animals they would be catching. After the hunt, the women would prepare the meal of the day as they sang. Olon learned quickly several of those songs and within a few days would sing along with them, and sometimes she would dance to the music of their voices. Meanwhile, the men would repair their nets and replenish their supply of darts in preparation for the next day's hunt. There were certain songs that the men would join in with chants, but most of the time they talked among themselves about the morning hunt. The whole tribe would then gather around the fire pit and have their meal presented to them on large, fresh tree leaves. The children were presented with the food first, and after they had their fill, the adults would eat. After all the food was consumed, there was nothing left except bones, animal skins, and nutshells. The bones and nutshells were gathered in the leaves and buried outside the camp and under the bulalo tree. The skins were used as clothing, such as loincloths, straps, pockets, and little bags to carry the various utensils that they used. After the daily meal, they would rest in their huts for a while until dusk arrived, at which time the young girls would go out and gather the wood needed for the fire pit that evening, as the women prepared the area around it. Darkness ushered in song and dance that depicted stories of their creation, stories of their ancestors, and most recently, the story of their battles. The story of their creation described the emergence of a salamander from the waters and its marriage to the spirit of the forest, giving forth the tribe's original mother and father, whose names were Olik and Balik, respectively. One song that they sang was about the courtship between Olik and Balik, where Olik would place the binto behind her right ear, signaling to Balik that she was ready to mate. Another song depicted a prayer to the Tuglusi capybara, where they call the capybara their brother, whom they thank for the gift of sustenance and giving them the ability to have many children. The tribe in turn only kills the adult capybara, leaving the children capybaras to thrive. The tribe also only stays in any one camp for 5 or 6 nights before moving on to the next place to make camp. When they perform this migration from one camp to the next, the men lead as they sing the migration song announcing their presence in the forest. When they arrive at their next campsite, the young girls gather the materials needed to build huts as the women build them. And in a matter of an hour, all the huts are completed. Meanwhile, the men and boys prepare the large fire pit by digging a shallow depression in the ground under a lean-to as protection from the rain. They gather the wood and start the fire from an ember they carried with them. Next chapter. Title: Lost in Translation. The forest was a tropical rainforest covering approximately 30,000 square miles. It was inhabited by the Gutrial hunter-gatherers, who were some of the oldest indigenous people of the Amazon Basin region. It was not known how long they, the Gutrial people, had been living in the forest. The Bantulo tribe, which was part of the Gutrial complex, consisted of 25 tribe members, and they occupied a territory of approximately 31 square miles. One morning, as the men and boys were out setting up their trapping nets, they ran across a small, fresh campsite that belonged to one or two people, and the fire pit was still smoldering. That indicated to them that they had intruders in their territory. They quickly called off the hunt to concentrate on finding the trespassers. One of the men examined the foliage around the camp and figured out their escape route, so the men and boys formed a straight line, shoulder to shoulder, and started moving forward in the direction of that escape route. Within an hour, they ran across a young man lying prostrate on the ground, surrendering to them with fear in his eyes. The Gutrial people of the region have a common language, so they were able to communicate with the young man and found out that he escaped from a bauxite work camp and had nowhere else to go. The men discussed among themselves what to do with this young muscular man, and they decided to incorporate him into the tribe. When they informed the young man of the decision, he went around trying to kiss the feet of the men and boys surrounding him. This was not the way of the Bantulo, and they didn't understand what he was trying to do. So one of them grabbed his arm, pulled him up, and told him he was one of the Bantulo tribe. He then lifted his loincloth and looked at his genitals, saying, "Haga Kabira." One by one, the rest of the men and boys did the same thing to the young man. They gave him the name of Kulongi. All the men and boys returned to the camp and introduced Kulongi to the rest of the tribe. On their way back, they managed to hunt for their daily needs of protein rations. The women took the meat and started preparing it for the daily meal, along with what they gathered, as the men were gone. That evening, the campfire festivities were centered around the introduction of Kulongi to the story of the Bantulo tribe. They performed and sang the drama and song of creation, where Olon played the part of the salamander that crawled out of the water, among other skits that identified the tribe from other tribes in that vast forest. In the Bantulo tribe, there was no pairing of women and men, nor was there marriage. The tribe is one family, and all individuals are cared for and loved by all others. There are no long-term sexual partners. There are no sexual partner rules, except that brothers and sisters cannot have sexual relations. Bantulo children recognize that all men are their fathers, and all women are their mothers. All adults recognize the children of the tribe as their own. At night, a woman may pair or may not pair with a man as a sleeping partner. The same goes for men. That is not to say that men or women do not have a favorite partner to sleep with for any length of time. Olon developed a fondness for Kulongi and would put the binto flower behind her right ear, glancing at him often and signaling that was ready to mate. They spent many a night in each other's arms. Olon wondered often why she was drawn to Kulongi, or he to her. To her, his muscular physique from working in the bauxite mines was attractive. There was also the fact that they were both outsiders coming into the tribe that drew them together. They often made mistakes in interpreting what was going on in the tribe during normal activities and were frequently corrected. For example, Olon was asked to wash and peel a tuber for their afternoon meal, so she jumped into the nearest pool of water to take a bath. This caused the whole tribe to break out in laughter, some of whom fell to the ground in uncontrollable fits of hilarity. These occasions were not meant to degrade Olon, but were genuinely happy moments for the whole tribe. Next chapter. Title: The Intruders. 3 years had now passed since Olon left Eugene, Oregon. Her firstborn was a boy whom the tribe named Olongo, who was now 2 years old. Her second child was a girl that the tribe named Olongi, now 1 year old. When Olon went out with the other women in the morning to gather, pick, and dig for food, she carried Olongi on her back, while Olongo was tethered to her waist with a long rope. It will be 2 more years before Olongo goes out with the men and other boys to trap and hunt. One day the tribe sensed that there were intruders in their territory because they found strange objects floating in the ponds. The tribespeople didn't know what they were except for Olon and Kulongi, who recognized the soggy cigarette butts as a sign that civilization was encroaching upon the tribe's territory. To Olon, this meant danger, for it was well known that many outsiders from the civilized world carry diseases that tribespeople die from. Olon and Kulongi could do little but warn the tribesmen of the danger. A few weeks later, as the tribe was convalescing after a great meal, two armed strangers walked into the camp and started to wake the tribe up using the butts of their rifles. As Kulongi and the other tribesmen started to go for their spears and poisoned darts, Olon begged them not to fight, for she realized that it would be futile. But Kulongi had already sent off a poisoned dart at one of the intruders that missed, and the stranger then shot Kulongi in the abdomen with his rifle. The shot was so loud that it startled the whole tribe. Olon continued to insist not to fight back as she rushed to comfort Kulongi. This time the tribesmen heeded what Olon was saying, and they put down their spears and darts and gathered around Kulongi, who was now moaning and bleeding profusely from his wound. It wasn't long before he died, and the wailing started by the women. After things calmed down, one of the intruders explained that the tribe could no longer hunt the Tiglusi capybara. When Olon asked why, the answer was that the Tiglusi capybara was on the endangered species list. Olon explained that the Tiglusi capybara was their main source of meat, but one of the intruders said they would just have to find another source of meat. Olon asked the intruders who they represented, and they said they represented a conservation organization based in the United States. The conservation group's name was Capybaras International, and they had purchased from the Brazilian government the surrounding 60 square miles of jungle and designated it as a conservation territory of theirs. They had an office in Brasilia and several helicopters to monitor the progress of their conservation efforts. After the intruders left, Olon tried to explain to the tribespeople what all this meant. She elucidated that they could no longer hunt for the Tiglusi capybara, and this generated a great deal of discussion among the tribesmen. When they asked why they could no longer hunt the Tiglusi capybara, she had a very hard time explaining what the endangered species list was, let alone that their territory had been purchased by a foreign organization. That night, there was no singing, dancing, or performances. The tribe was in a glum mood. The men put their walking sticks together in a show of solidarity with one another. There was a great deal of discussion among them, and in the end, they decided to ignore the commands of the intruders and continue to hunt the Tiglusi capybara. The next day, the tribesmen lifted Kulongi a tree and laid him to rest on a branch lined with special leaves. Although they had made camp 2 days earlier, they decided to move on and make a new camp deeper into the jungle in hopes of getting farther away from the intruders. About a month later, they heard a helicopter overhead, and Olon read the words, "Capybaras International," on its side, and a chill ran up her spine. The tribe had seen helicopters before, so it was nothing new. They regarded them as big birds and occasionally shot arrows at them. Olon had a dilemma of whether to tell them where the bird was from or not. In the end, she decided to tell them that the bird was from the armed men who killed Kulongi. Again, they decided to move the camp deeper into the jungle to get away from those armed men, for they thought they were flying on the big birds. At this point, Olon decided she had to do something to help her tribe. After a great deal of thought, she decided to go to Brasilia to find out where the Capybaras International Conservation Group was located and try to talk them out of their restrictions on her tribe for hunting the Tiglusi capybara. Next chapter. Title, Brasilia. That evening around the campfire, she decided to tell the tribe what her intentions were. She solicited their help in gathering enough skins to make covers for her breasts and her other private parts. It took her approximately 3 weeks to reach Brasilia. She found a cheap hotel called the Grand Green River. She went up to the front desk clerk and asked her if she could use her cell phone to contact Maggie in Eugene, Oregon, USA, and the clerk, whose name tag read Juanita, hesitated then agreed after Olon guaranteed she would pay her handsomely. She contacted Maggie for more monetary help for her stay there at the hotel and the purchase of civilized attire. Once established, she found out where the office of the Capybaras International Conservation Group was and knocked on their door. The office was in a tall glass building on the sixth floor. As she walked in, there were pictures of the Tiglusi capybara all over the walls. She asked to meet the director, and after getting the runaround, she finally got in to plead her case and the case of her tribe. After introductions and salutations, Olon got down to business. She explained that her tribe, the Bantulo, and the other tribes in the area needed the Tiglusi capybara for survival, that it was their major source of meat. The director said, "Your tribe and the tribes in your area are not my priority. What is a priority to us is the Tiglusi capybara and its survival. Your tribe and the tribes in your area are not in danger like the Tiglusi capybara, and I will have to insist that your tribe cease from killing any of these capybaras." Olon replied, "I will beg to differ. The tribespeople of the Amazon basin are just as much in danger as the Tiglusi capybaras." The director went on to argue, "My business is not to save the tribes, but to save the Tiglusi capybara. Once we save the capybara and its environment, the tribes will be better off. Meanwhile, until that happens, they will have to stop hunting the Taglusi capybara. Olun went on pleading her case by saying, "It is good of you to talk of the environment of the Amazon basin. That environment includes both capybaras and humans. They both coexist with one another in a balance." The director cut her off and said, "I have to reiterate that the capybaras are in danger, and the tribespeople are not in danger. The Taglusi capybara numbers are dwindling drastically. We have bought and set up a reserve for these capybaras so that they can thrive." Olun countered and said, "You don't understand. If you let the Taglusi capybara numbers grow beyond a certain point, they will run out of food to eat and the population will come crashing down. The tribespeople help keep the Taglusi capybara numbers at a sustainable level." The director countered with, "And if the tribespeople numbers increase, they will eat all the Taglusi capybaras, and the tribespeople population will come crashing down." "You see, your argument does not make sense," Olun explained. "The Taglusi capybaras and tribespeople have been living together for generations, if not thousands of years. And you, as an outsider, to come in and decide you know what is best after a few years in college is no proof that your argument will hold water. You can leave right now, whatever your name is, for I've never been so insulted in my life. I suppose you have an education that is better than mine?" said the director. "It doesn't matter about our education. What does matter is the welfare of the jungle, the Amazon basin. The test of time is the acid test that we should go by. Yes, I have a college education, and if there's anything that I learned in college, it is that I know very little of the workings of the world. But what I do know is that nature is the great teacher, and that our books are but shadowy interpretations of it," responded Olun as she picked up her handbag and left. Next chapter. Title: Preparing to Do Battle. When Olun returned to her cheap Grand Green River hotel, she discovered that her room landline couldn't call long distance. She went down to the front desk and asked Juanita, the attendant, if she knew of a place that sold phones that can call long distance. Juanita responded with the name of the store and where it was located. So she walked to the phone store and purchased a cell phone that could call long distance to the U.S., and she called Maggie. "Hello," answered Maggie. "Hi, Mom, it's Olun. How are you doing? I hope you're okay. I need your help." She quickly brought Maggie up to date about her interaction with the U.S.-based conservation organization and her efforts to save her tribe. "What should I do?" she asked. Maggie thought for a moment and then advised Olun to get a lawyer familiar with saving the tribes of the Amazonian jungle basin in Brasilia and taking the conservation group to court to try to stop them from implementing their ban on hunting the Taglusi capybara. "But they have a small office. Their main office is in the U.S., responded Olun. "I tried that before. I went to Texas to fight the main organization that was logging my tribe's territory, and it turned out that all their resources were there, and I had a difficult time. So, keep the battle in Brasilia away from the main office. That way you would have the upper hand, or a better hand anyway," argued Maggie. "But won't taking them to court cost a lot of money?" asked Olun. "Yes, but the exchange rate is very high, and I can take care of it from here, no problem. Besides, lawyers are not that expensive in Brazil," responded Maggie. "But how do I select a lawyer? And do they take care of starting a lawsuit and a court case, or do I have to do all that?" asked Olun. "A good lawyer will do all that for you." "The key is selecting a good lawyer," answered Maggie. "And how do I do that?" responded Olun. "You can advertise in the local paper. Be specific as to what you're looking for. When you try to select a lawyer from a group of lawyers, and I'm sure that a group of lawyers will be answering the ad, you will just have to trust your gut feeling and let your passion drive your decision," responded Maggie. Olun placed an ad in the prominent paper for a lawyer that read the following: "A tribal protection lawyer is needed. Must be experienced in Amazon jungle basin tribal issues and conservation efforts. Call 555-1234. While waiting for a response, Olun decided to put down on paper some of her thoughts about the existence of humans. These thoughts developed into an essay she eventually submitted to the Journal of Anthropological Studies. The article was entitled The Story of Humans. After about a week, she received 6 inquiries for the position. She picked 4 that looked promising and called them back requesting their resumes. After going over the resumes, she picked 3 to interview. Out of the 3, a lawyer by the name of Alejandro Ramirez made a connection with her inner feelings, so Olon asked him to meet her for coffee at a local coffee shop. She said she would be wearing a red scarf. Alejandro was about 5'9" tall with wavy dark hair and dark brown eyes. He walked up to her table as she was reading a newspaper that morning and said, "Excuse me, miss. I'm looking for Miss Olon." "You must be Mr. Ramirez," said Olon as she stood up and extended her right hand to shake his. "Please have a seat." "Will you join me in a cup of coffee?" she asked. "Thank you, I will, Miss Olon," said Alejandro. "Oh, please call me Olon," she responded. "I too prefer you call me just Alejandro," he said. Olon called the waiter over and ordered a coffee for Alejandro. "I was impressed by your resume and our phone meeting last Friday. I am ready to give you the job of defending my tribe in court. But first, tell me a little bit about yourself. Maybe you can start by telling me your philosophy of the whole tribal situation in Brazil." "I come from a tribe called the Lupi that lived in a jungle in an area north of Manaus that now consists of grazing land for a farmer named Baron Juan Valdez. Some of my ancestors had no choice but to work for the Baron while others dispersed to other areas. I come from the ancestors who worked for the Baron. My grandfather learned accounting and made enough money to send my father to college, where he graduated in agriculture. Eventually, the Baron took my father on as the second manager of the farm. It seems that you and your family found your place in the Baron's farm enterprise. So what made you become a lawyer to defend the tribes?" asked Olon. "In secret, my family kept the old ways and traditions alive. This captivated my imagination as a young boy, and when I was 18 years of age, I decided to go and hunt for the dispersed part of my family. I found a group of them living in the Negra River area who were battling the oil companies that devastated their tribal lands. That was the time that I decided to become a lawyer to defend them. But by the time I finished college 10 years later, the battle was lost, and now I turn to other tribes to try to help them against the onslaught of greedy companies," answered Alejandro. "But why do you feel you need to defend the tribes against the greedy companies?" Olon asked. "Why don't you help them join these companies like your father and grandfather did when they joined the Baron and his enterprise of raising cattle?" "It really comes down to survival," answered Alejandro. "The way that you and I are living today has a tremendous negative effect on the ability of Earth to recover. You see, nature had intended for us all to live off of the rays of the sun, but somewhere along the line, humans veered off course and started using alternative sources of energy like fossil fuels. It is comparable to nature building an engine that runs on gasoline and humans using salad dressing to put in its gas tank. The Earth just doesn't work that way." "I'm confused. Nature didn't build engines that run on gasoline. Could you please clarify?" Olon asked of Alejandro. "You're right, Olon. If you just substitute sunshine for gasoline and gasoline for salad dressing in the previous example, you will get a better picture. So I should have said, nature built an engine that runs off of sunshine, and humans using gasoline to put in the sunshine tank. The engine nature intended will not run. People will still not understand. Humans have built engines that run on gasoline, and these engines provide transportation and help us build skyscrapers and factories to feed the whole world. What's wrong in that?" "Gasoline engines have side effects. For one thing, they pollute the air. A second side effect is that we have to gouge the earth in order to build roads. To build roads, we have to kill vegetation, cut down trees. Not only that, but other engines that run on gasoline are used for mining. These activities again gouge earth and disturb the fauna and flora to a point where they cannot return to the way they were. Still, other engines are used for agriculture and planting crops. In this case, whole landscapes are denuded of their original vegetation and fauna, and in its place, we plant foods for human consumption, and the list goes on. All these activities are not what nature had intended for earth. They are plain wrong." "Now you're becoming clearer to me. Your description of the killing of plants and animals, the disfigurement of the earth, and the spewing of toxins in the air as well as on the earth reminds me of a concept I learned in biology. It is the concept of the environmental footprint, which tries to measure the impact of man on the natural environment. Before the advent of humans, the natural environment consisted of plants and animals that had zero footprints because, one, they depended on the sun for energy, and two, this energy cascaded down and through plants and animals until it is totally dissipated without leaving any scars or side effects, added Olan. The problem as I see it, continued Olan, is how are we going to relate the Tuglusi capybara and my tribe to the discussion and to the court, asked Olan. Olan could see the gears turning in Alejandro's head as he sat there thinking about what to say. Finally, he looked at Olan and said, "We'll make it an issue of the whole Amazonian jungle and all the creatures within it, including the Tuglusi capybara and all tribes and its invasion by foreigners who only want to rape the land of resources that will never be returned. We'll show that these invaders are the ones who are responsible for killing the capybaras and not the tribespeople, that the tribespeople are not the ones causing the endangerment of the Tuglusi capybara." Butterflies started flying in Olan's gut as she felt the project was getting out of hand. As far as she knew, hundreds, if not thousands, of companies were involved. "Don't you think we're biting off too much? There are at least hundreds of companies devouring the Amazon basin jungles, and I have a feeling if we take them all on, they will all jump down our throats, and we will lose the case because we just don't have the resources to do battle with them all," replied Olan with concern. "What do you suggest, Olan?" asked Alejandro. "I think we better keep our scope narrow to that of my tribe and the Tuglusi capybara. That way, we keep the battle simple against a small conservation office here in Brasilia." "But I think you're missing the point, Olan. The battle is not between you and the office of the conservation group. The battle is between you and the invaders over the health of the Amazonian jungles." "We will just have to make it the battle between me, my tribe, and the conservation office," insisted Olan. "There are dangers with your approach, Olan. If we get involved with the nitty-gritty, we will fall into the quagmire of red tape instead of fighting a conceptual battle where it is our logic against theirs. But if you want to take that course of drawing the battle line between you and the conservation office, I'll do my best to save your tribe, the Tuglusi capybara, and their jungle environment," responded Alejandro. Next chapter. Title: Getting Down. I found a great lawyer, Maggie. His name is Alejandro Ramirez, and I feel that we are on the same wavelength as far as the conservation group, the Tuglusi capybara, and my tribe. Great, Olan, but be careful. Some lawyers down there go for the higher bidders, and we are on a limited budget. You don't want to get mixed up in that game. Of course, I've never done this before, Maggie, but I feel that he is committed to our side, for he comes from a similar background. Anyway, we are going to take the Capybara International Conservation Group to court here in Brasilia, since this is where their office is located. I'd rethink that part, Olan. Your resources are stretched all the way from the U.S. to the federal capital of Brazil, and that is very convenient for them. If I were you, I'd take them to court in your neck of the woods, perhaps in the city of Manaus, where they will have to stretch their dollars and other resources. Both Olan and Alejandro thought that Maggie's suggestion to move the trial to Manaus was a good one, so they packed up their bags and headed out to the capital of the state Amazonas via train. The morning after they arrived in Manaus, they went to the courthouse and filed a lawsuit against the Capybara International Conservation Group, claiming they were endangering the Tuglusi capybara and the human inhabitants of the Bontulo jungle area. The trial was set for 65 days later, and notice was sent out to the Capybara International Conservation Group in Brasilia. While waiting for the trial date, Olan and Alejandro worked on putting the finishing touches on the arguments they will be presenting in court in support of their case and the disclosure statement they will be giving to the conservation group. This wasn't going to be a jury trial, but a trial by judge. The judge's name was Juan Valdez, and he was known to have sided with companies in similar trials. So, they had their work cut out for them to make sure the judge had no wiggle room. Their work often took all day to complete, and many times late into the night. They used to switch rooms between Olan's and Alejandro's depending on where the paperwork was. One night when they were working in Olan's room, the clock struck midnight, and Olan asked Alejandro if it was okay if she changed into her night attire, and he shrugged his shoulders. So, Olan took off her blouse, then her skirt, followed by her bra, and as her panties melted away from her thighs, Alejandro started to sweat. She resumed working on the graph that depicted a balanced population of Taglusi capybaras and Bontulo tribespeople. Olan assumed that since Alejandro was a native, he wouldn't mind her nakedness, but she was wrong, for he was now swallowing hard, and she could see the gears turning in his head. "I'm sorry, Alejandro. Am I making you feel uncomfortable?" Well, Alejandro grew up in a Western society setting at the ranch, and he wasn't accustomed to nakedness like she was. But he pretended it was all right and said, "No, you are not making me nervous. I just wasn't expecting it, that's all. I can do the same, you know." Olan sensed that he was lying and decided to play along and suggested that he take off his clothes as well. Alejandro got a little flustered and decided to take off his clothes in the bathroom. Then he peeked out of the crack in the door to see if she was watching and found that she was indeed waiting for him to come out. Well, they didn't get much done that evening, and they ended up sleeping in each other's arms. In the morning, Alejandro got a bright idea. He thought instead of making a chart of the balance between the tribespeople and the capybara, he to build a mobile that included the tribespeople, the capybaras, and a few other birds and animals to make it look more realistic. The intent was that by removing the people from the mobile would be out of balance and collapse, which was more dramatic than a paper chart. Olan thought it was a brilliant idea and said, "Where have you been hiding all this talent, Alejandro? Where have you been all my life?" as she looked into his eyes. Next chapter. Title: The Court Battle, Part Number 1. At noon on the appointed day, Judge Juan Valdez ordered the court into session by thumping his desk with his gavel. He was an older gentleman of about 60 years, with wrinkly skin on his face, and one of his eyes was missing. "As I understand it, the Capybara International Conservation Group wants to save the capybara, while the Bontulo tribespeople do not want them to do that. Is that correct?" he asked, pointing to the conservation group's desk. "Yes, that is correct, Your Honor," replied the lawyer for the conservation group, Alberto Rodriguez, as he stood up. The judge then turned his attention to Alejandro and said, "Is that correct, Señor Alejandro Ramirez?" "Not quite, Your Honor," responded Alejandro. "It is in the best interest of the Bontulo tribespeople that the Taglusi capybara survives and does not go extinct, so their intention is also to save the capybara." "So what is the problem exactly, since you both want to save this capybara?" asked the judge. "According to the Bontulo tribespeople," continued Alejandro, "the conservation group's logic is flawed and will not work." "I object, Your Honor," countered Alberto. "How can encouraging the tribespeople to kill the Taglusi capybara save it from extinction? I contend that the tribespeople's logic is in error." "Very well. So we will be deciding whose logic is correct and whose logic is not correct. But first we need to go over some basics. I have in front of me the documentation on the Taglusi capybara. I have its territory and the conservation group's purchased territory boundaries, the capybara's scientific name, and the estimated number of its population. Unfortunately, I do not have a similar description of the Bontulo tribespeople. All I have is Miss Olan as the person representing the tribe with her Brazilian national ID. Can you fill me in, Mr. Ramirez, with the rest of the details that I need, such as the number of people in the tribe, their Brazilian IDs, and the tribe's official territory?" "There are 26 individuals in the Bontulo tribe, including Miss Olan, Your Honor," responded Alejandro as he picked up a sheet of paper from his desk and handed it to the judge. He continued, "These are the names of the Bontulo tribespeople. They have no national Brazilian IDs, for they are a secluded and uncontacted tribe. As far as their territory is concerned, it is not set in stone because it varies with the season of the year. I hate to disappoint you, but I will need their national Brazilian IDs and the boundaries of their territory. That's the minimum I require in order to come up with a solution and a verdict. How much time do you need to get this information for me so we can move forward, Señor Alejandro? Asked the judge. Acting as if he knew everything when he didn't, Alejandro responded with, 2 months, Your Honor, which was a wild guess. Very well. The trial will resume 60 days from today, and you better be ready, Señor Alejandro, said the judge as he brought down the gavel onto his desk. Next chapter. Title: The Art of the Deal. As they left the courtroom, Maggie's heart started to beat a little faster. Her breathing became heavier, and a vein started showing on her forehead. But she kept quiet until they were sitting at the dinner table, waiting for their order to come, when she burst out and said, We can't go through with it. We can't do what the judge is asking us to do. It's just impossible and dangerous. What do you mean, Olan? Asked Alejandro, who was surprised by her reaction. Surely 2 months is enough to do what we need to do. That's not what I mean, she replied. My tribe will be devastated. Do you know what the statistics are for tribespeople getting in contact with the civilized people? Half of them end up dying from simple diseases, such as the flu and measles. I didn't realize it was that severe, replied Alejandro. We will just have to figure out a way to get around these obstacles. Tomorrow we'll go together to the Citizen Registry office and see what is required. They entered the main door to the Citizen Registry office, which was housed in the annex of the courthouse, at 10 o'clock in the morning. Excuse me, sir, said Alejandro to the clerk at the registration desk. I have a problem, and I think you can help me with the solution. What is your problem, senor? Asked the clerk, who was a short fellow, a little on the heavy side, with large ears and a mustache. I am required by the courts to provide IDs for each member of a tribe that lives deep in the jungle about 3 weeks away. This tribe has never been in contact with civilized people before. I'm wondering if you could travel with us to the tribe with your equipment to give each one of the 25 members a national ID card? Asked Alejandro. 3 weeks away? I'm sorry, but I don't think I can do that. That means a 6-week round trip plus. Besides, the equipment is very bulky and heavy, and I'll need electricity. No, my wife will never agree to it, said the clerk. I'm sorry, but each one of the 25 members of the tribe must come into this office and be processed like every other individual in this great nation of ours. That's almost impossible, said Alejandro. We need to find an easier way to get their IDs. What if I take the equipment with me, travel there, process them, and come back and you fill out the ID cards? No, that will never do, the clerk answered. That would put a stop to the whole office production line for 6 weeks or more. Besides, I can't give you any government equipment because you're not a government employee. Who do you think you are coming around here asking for this and that? We run by rules in this office. Alejandro turned around and whispered in Olan's ear, Do you have 100 reals to give this man? Olan searched in her handbag, then shook Alejandro's hand and deposited in it the 100 reals. Alejandro then said to the clerk, Thank you very much, sir, and shook his hand, passing the 100 reals to him. He then pretended he was leaving the office. He turned around to the clerk once again and asked if they had any old equipment that he could use. The clerk took the money and said, One moment, sir, I'll check in the back. After about 5 minutes, he returned shaking his head and said, I'm sorry, but I don't have any. Alejandro then turned around and whispered in Olan's ear to give him another 100 reals, which Olan again did discreetly. This time, Alejandro slid the money over the counter to the clerk. As the clerk put his hand on the money, Alejandro put his hand on the clerk's and whispered, If you don't help us right now, I'm going to yell that you take bribes. The clerk then said in a whisper, Keep your voice down, I'll help you, but you will have to promise me you will not tell anyone about this. He then slipped the money into his pocket. Alejandro nodded in the affirmative, and the clerk returned to the back room. A minute later, he placed a green box on the counter. He then whispered, This is a box of 30 ID cards. You are to write the person's name where it says name, then staple the picture of each tribal member where indicated on a separate ID card. The picture is to be 3 centimeters by 4 centimeters and in color. Then return them to me. Alejandro whispered. I'll have them back to you in about a month or so.
Then he grabbed Olan's hand, and they quickly exited the office. They went straight to the hotel room, where Olan packed her backpack for the trip back to the tribe the next day. She made sure she had her cell phone with her to take pictures of each individual of the tribe. The plan was for her to get back, print the pictures, and staple them to the ID cards. Next chapter. Title: The Deed. Olan and Alejandro started at 6 a.m. together. Alejandro was going to accompany her to the edge of the forests where he would wait for her to return with the pictures of her tribe's people. They hitchhiked most of the way in cars and on open-air trucks carrying merchandise and other items. The last truck they were on was carrying dynamite for one of the mines. Olan hiked for about 6 days until she came upon where the tribe had been when she left them. Not finding them there, she followed the tracks, and 2 days later could see the smoke from their fire pit. She was fully clothed and did not want to scare them, so she took her clothes off, put them in the backpack, and proceeded towards the camp. She was greeted with open arms into the fold once again, and she was happy to see her children, hugging and kissing them. She then proceeded to build her hut. She didn't tell them about what she was there to do. She felt she would wait until the next day. Meanwhile, she enjoyed being part of the group again, especially in the evening when they danced and sang and did their skits. After the hunt in the morning and preparing the food at noon, she thought she would introduce her cell phone to the tribe so they could get comfortable with it. The tribe members passed the phone around to the next person, not knowing what it was, but just getting a feel for it. After they ate the meal of the day, she told them what she was going to do with the cell phone, and that was to take their pictures. One woman named Gatul asked her what a picture was. Olan didn't have a straight answer for her, and she tried by drawing a picture of herself on the ground and calling it a picture. She then showed Getula how to take a picture with her cell phone by clicking a button after aiming the cell phone at Olan. The first try of taking a picture turned out all blurry, so they tried again and finally they got some images of Olan's face. Getula gasped when she saw Olan's picture. Yanhar Abyad Anasaraked Ruhik, which meant, "Oh my gosh, it stole your soul!" Olan tried to tell her that it wasn't her soul, but an image just like the one she drew out on the ground, but with more detail. Getul just would not accept that as an explanation, and she thought that the cell phone was Shaitan. Getul started to tell other tribespeople that it was Shaitan and advised Olan to throw it away. Olan started to feel depressed and had no idea how to turn these events around. That evening, the tribespeople kept their distance during the activities around the campfire. She felt shunned, so she didn't bring up the case of the cell phone again and hid it in her backpack. The next evening, she decided to tell the tribe what she had to do to protect them from the conservation group's activities. She stood up in front of the campfire and explained that there were people who wanted to keep them from hunting the capybara, and that they went to the white-faced wise man, and he said that she must take their pictures to save the capybara for them. Getul stood up and said that the white-faced wise man was the Shaitan, that he wanted to take the tribespeople's souls, and that all would die a terrible death. She continued to say that Olan was the Shaitan's emissary. He stole her soul and gave her the cell phone so that she may steal the souls of everyone else. Olan pleaded with the tribe and told them that this was the only way she could save their hunt for the capybara. But Getuli called her a liar and said that she was from the Shaitan's dark shadow. Olan felt defeated and started to cry. She then retreated to her hut. There was no more singing, music, or skits that night. Olan felt helpless and drifted in and out of sleep that night, and by morning she had figured out what to do. She took the cell phone and started to take about a dozen selfies of her face in different funny looks. She was hoping to make the cell phone appear to be harmless, humorous, and amusing instead of a threat. She casually walked over to a young girl whom she thought did not understand what was going on and started showing her the pictures on her cell phone. The girl started to giggle, then laugh, and eventually fell to the ground, holding her stomach and laughing her head off.
One by one, the rest of the tribe gathered around them, trying to find out what was going on. And as Olan passed the pictures around, they all started to laugh hysterically.
"You see," said Olan, "it is not a device of the Shaitan."
She let the cell phone go from person to person and enjoyed the look on their faces as they flipped through the different poses she had made. Even Getul joined in the laughter and must have realized that it was not a device of the Shaitan after all. After this joyous breakthrough, Olan was able to take portrait shots of all the tribespeople, then started her trek back to where Alejandro was waiting for her. They continued to Manaus, arriving a week before the deadline. Alejandro affixed the pictures to the ID cards with two staples each. Olan then wrote down the name of each person in the tribe under their picture, and they took the box of ID cards back to the courthouse annex and presented it to the clerk. The clerk opened up the box and right away said, "This will never do. I thought I told you each person had to sign their ID card," and gave the box back to Alejandro.
"You never told us to have each person sign the ID card," responded Alejandro.
"Besides, the tribespeople don't know how to write. So what are we supposed to do now?"
"You can affix the thumbprint of each person in place of their signature," said the clerk as he handed Alejandro an ink pad.
Next chapter, title. Title, Double Deed. Back at the Grand Green River Hotel, Olan said, "We only have a week left. I don't have enough time to get to the tribe and get their thumbprints on the ID cards and get back in time. Do you have enough money to hire a helicopter?"
responded Alejandro.
"Well, I have enough money, but I think we need to spend it on the court instead of a helicopter," Maggie said. "I see no option but to hike out there again and try to get their thumbprints on these ID cards," responded Alejandro. Both Olan and Alejandro took off from Manaus that same day in hopes that they could travel fast and get to the tribe and back before the trial started in a week. But there was no pushing it. They reached the edge of the jungle, and there were only 2 days left, and they knew they would never make it. So they traveled back to Manaus with the realization that they probably lost the court case. With 1 day left, Olan came up with the clandestine idea that she put her thumbprint on all the ID cards and handed them in. Alejandro reminded her that her thumbprint would look the same on each ID card, and that would give away their whole plan and ruin the ID cards. An hour later, Alejandro thought some more about the situation and came up with the idea of using different fingers for different tribe members, but they only had 20 fingers between them. He then suggested using toes to complete the set of 25. That sounded like a plausible idea to Olan, who said she would like to sleep on the idea before carrying it out. The next morning, she told Alejandro, "Let's do it." And they proceeded to ink every finger and toe necessary to have unique prints on every ID card. After the deed was done, they proceeded to the courthouse annex and presented the ID cards to the clerk. The clerk examined them suspiciously on account that they all didn't look like thumbprints. He picked up one card, examined it, and then commented to Alejandro that the thumbprint was kind of little and too small to be of an adult. Alejandro took the ID card, looked at it, and said, "That one tribe member had delicate hands and fingers." In the end, the clerk accepted all the ID cards and proceeded to stamp them with the official Brazilian embossing stamp. He then gave them all back to Alejandro and instructed him to return to the jungle and give each tribe member their ID card, and that they should carry it at all times on their person. Olan and Alejandro had to tackle the boundaries of the tribe's territory next. Unlike the Capybara Conservation Group's square territory, the tribe's territory was more or less circular and irregular at that. Olan had taken the GPS coordinates of the camp she was in while in the jungle with her tribe, and Alejandro decided to draw a circular territory around that campsite that included about 36 square miles. This territory was drawn out on a Google map and superimposed on the territory declared by the Capybara International Conservation Group's property boundaries. Next chapter. Title: The Court Battle, Part Number 2. On the next day and after the introductions, the judge asked Alejandro for the documentation that was requested of him in the previous court session. Alejandro presented the list of tribal names with corresponding ID numbers and the Google map outlining the coordinates of the tribe's circular territory. The court session then proceeded with the judge requesting Alejandro's opening statement. Alejandro stood up and said, "The Bantulo tribe and the Taglusi capybara existed together in balance for thousands of generations without one or the other going extinct or being harmed in any way. To put restrictions on or eliminate the hunting of the Taglusi capybara would upset this balance and cause harm to the jungle's environment. That was my statement, Your Honor." Alejandro then sat down and the judge pointed to the lawyer for the conservation group and asked him to give their opening statement. Alberto Rodriguez then stood up and said, "It is true that the capybara and the tribespeople of the Amazon jungle lived in harmony for thousands of generations, but the reality of the matter is modern man has invaded the jungle and put the capybara in danger of extinction. So, the balance in the jungle between the tribes and the capybara has changed due to this invasion. Our conservation group has no control over this invasion, but we do have control over the land that we have purchased. And to save the capybara from extinction, we need to stop its killing in our territory." The judge then asked Señor Alberto if there was proof that the capybara was on the endangered species list, and Señor Alberto presented the endangered species list of the United Americas Science Foundation to him, which included the Taglusi capybara. "And what are the numbers behind this declaration of endangerment, Señor Alberto?" the judge asked. "It is estimated that 50 years ago, there were 3 million Taglusi capybara in the Amazon jungle. Today, there are less than 4,000 left," answered Señor Alberto. "And what do you say to that, Señor Alejandro?" "The Taglusi capybara has a limited territory per individual, and they do not roam all over the whole jungle. There are approximately 2,000 Taglusi capybara in the Bantulo tribe's territory, and that number has not changed for generations. What is causing the danger to the Taglusi capybara, as Señor Alberto mentioned, is the encroachment of human invaders from outside with their business enterprises. And we contend that the danger is not from indigenous tribes, Your Honor," responded Alejandro. "And what do you have to say to that, Señor Alberto?" asked the judge. "Señor Alejandro is right. The danger to the Taglusi capybara is from outside businesses invading their territory. And we have taken action by purchasing the land, and in doing so, we will prevent further encroachment by these outsiders. We will attempt to save the last 4,000 capybaras. Therefore, we propose that these last 4,000 not be hunted or harmed in any way." "Do you have anything to say to that, Señor Alejandro?" asked the judge. "We contend, Your Honor, that hunting the Taglusi capybara is not harming them, but maintaining a healthy population in balance with its human counterparts, namely the Bantulo tribe. The tribe will protect them, for the capybara is its main source of meat," responded Alejandro. "I object, Your Honor," interjected Señor Alberto. "The whole Amazon basin has been in danger by the incursion of outside businesses, and the current tribes that live there have failed in keeping them out and protecting their food sources. We contend that if control is given to the Bantulo tribe of what's remaining of the Taglusi capybara population, it will result in its extinction, as it has in many other areas of the Amazonian jungle. We have purchased the land, and we will protect it through the court systems against the incursion of foreign businesses." "Something which the tribe cannot do," responded Señor Alberto. The judge looked at Alejandro and asked, "Can your Bantulo tribe members protect the Taglusi capybara in the Brazilian courts against the influx of opportunistic businesses?" "No, Your Honor. The tribe members are illiterate, and they live deep in the jungle. As a matter of fact, they have very little contact with the outside world, if any. But the tribe does have control over the health of the jungle, for they are participants, and they maintain a balance between the humans and the rest of the jungle, including the Taglusi capybara." Alejandro then displayed to the judge the mobile they had constructed in the hotel room, and on the mobile were half a dozen animals, including the Taglusi capybara and the humans. "You see, Your Honor, if we take the humans out of the equation in the jungle," and at this point, Alejandro removed the human figure from the mobile, and the mobile collapsed. The mobile collapses, and there will be no capybara or any other animals without the existence of the human tribe members.
Very well done, Signor Alejandro. But I have a problem with the mobile that you constructed. I can't imagine the whole jungle falling apart and all the animals dying just because we stopped hunting the Taglusi capybara.
The mobile is a little too unrealistic in my eyes, said the judge.
I think the main problem is who is in control of the jungle. And as far as I can tell, the Capybara Conservation Group, represented by Signor Alberto, has demonstrated that they can protect the jungle in the Brazilian courts, and in which the tribespeople live from outside intruders, which is the main danger to the Taglusi capybara. They have title to the land and therefore a legal precedent in the courts to protect the capybara.
Do you have any rebuttal to this argument, Signor Alejandro? Asked the judge.
Yes, Your Honor. I contend that the Capybara Conservation Group protect a whole jungle, and not only the Taglusi capybara that includes the tribespeople. And to leave the Bantulo tribe to maintain a healthy capybara population by hunting the mature, elderly, and the weak, as they have been doing for the past 1,000 generations.
I object, Your Honor, said Signor Alberto. There are only a limited number of capybaras left, and we cannot continue to hunt them. We must protect them. What if an outsider comes in with a gun and starts shooting them?
The Bantulo tribespeople are in no way in a position to protect the Taglusi capybara in this situation. It's understood that for thousands of years, the tribespeople and the capybara existed in harmony. But today's world is full of uncertainties, and we will be irresponsible if we continue to let the tribespeople hunt the Taglusi capybara as they have been doing in the past.
I will have to take both your arguments under advisement, and we shall continue tomorrow with my final verdict, said the judge as he slammed the gavel on his desk.
Next chapter. Title: The Verdict. After introductions the next day, the judge asked Signor Alberto and Signor Alejandro if they had anything to add to their arguments of the previous day. Signor Alberto responded, "No, Your Honor." But Alejandro wanted to add the following. The Bantulo tribespeople were not consulted or given a chance to have a say in the sale of the land to the Capybara Conservation Group. What happened was a Brazilian government employee made that decision for them, which is unfair and downright criminal to give somebody else's land, namely the Bantulo tribespeople's land, to a foreign non-governmental organization. It is true that the Bantulo tribespeople now have ID cards and are part of the Brazilian Commonwealth. They are still considered subhuman to be traded, sold, and bought like cattle simply because they prefer to live a primitive lifestyle. With that statement, Alejandro sat down. The judge then said, "Based on the evidence and arguments presented here with regards to who has control, or should I say better control, of the future of the Taglusi capybara, I hereby declare the Capybara International Conservation Group the guardian of the Taglusi capybara, and that all people, including the Bantulo tribespeople, are to refrain from hunting it." And the judge's gavel went down for the very last time. Next chapter. Title: The Aftermath. As Olan approached the campfire, the Bantulo tribespeople could see the worry in her eyes, for she did not look happy with the corners of her mouth drooping. Kitulo, the brother of Getul, approached her, taking her hand and leading her to the circle around the campfire. By this time, the shadows were very long, and they were all settling in for a night of dance and song. Olon sat in their midst, not knowing whether to tell them then or to tell them later of the devastating news. Kitulo leaned toward her and asked her what was wrong.
"I come with bad news, Kitulo," she said in a whisper. "I do not want to spoil tonight's festivities, and I'd rather tell you tomorrow." He accepted her decision, and the festivities continued that night like they did every night. In the morning, Kitulo approached Olon and told her that he was ready for whatever news she had to give him. So she told him they could not hunt the Taglusi capybara anymore. The law of the Wazongos has declared that it is sacred, and they could not eat it anymore. Kitulo gathered the elder tribe members, and they discussed for a long time what she had told him. Getule, the woman who opposed taking the pictures before Olon left, started speaking out loud, criticizing Olon for introducing the Wazongo's laws into their world. She started making contorted poses symbolizing death and destruction as she wailed. This seemed to agree with the mood of the rest of the elders, and they started following her example in making distorted poses and wailing. After about 6 or 7 minutes, the wailing died down, and the elders returned to fixing their nets, preparing their spears and arrows for the hunt that day. Kitulo approached Olon and told her that the tribe would not follow the Wazongo's laws, and that the sacred capybara would continue to be hunted. Olon figured that would be their response. That night, Kitulo led a group of tribe members in the performance of the sacred Taglusi capybara song and dance, which lasted for about an hour. They had captured a capybara that morning and saved it for this evening, and at the end of the celebrations, each tribe member whispered in its ear to go and warn all the other capybara of impending doom. Then they let the capybara go, and it scurried into the darkness. Life continued for the tribe with hunting in the morning, cooking during the noontime, feasting in the afternoon, and the nightly ritual of the telling of stories relating creation and life with song and dance. The only different thing was that they held a special skit at the beginning of the evening activities for the Taglusi capybara, where the young children had their faces painted with the markings of the capybara. Approximately 2 months later, two intruders with guns were spotted in their territory. Olon thought for sure the tribespeople would hide all indications of the capybara that was usually found in the camp, but they did not. Left around were its skins, bones, and tails. Olon rushed to Kitulo to warn him and to have the tribespeople hide the evidence. Kitulo said that the Bantulo tribe will not hide, for they are strong and will overcome. That the Bantulo tribe lives for the capybara, and the capybara lives for them. That no man can deny one from the other. The tribespeople ignored the two intruders as they entered the campground, continuing about their business of preparing the food for the afternoon meal. The intruders were looking for live or dead capybara and did not find any, so they were satisfied and started to leave when one of them noticed a capybara pelt on a log. "Who does this pelt belong to?" asked the leader of the two. Kitulo came forward and said, "It is mine." The lead intruder then grabbed a hold of his arm, placed a handcuff on his wrist, and said, "You are coming with me to be tried in Manaus for the killing of the Taglusi capybara." Olon right away felt that he'd never survive the trip nor the incarceration waiting for him, so she came forth and said, "The pelt was from before the ban, senor." The lead intruder then asked her if she could prove that it was a pelt from before the ban, and she responded by saying that if he felt it, he would notice that it was dry and crackly, namely that it was an old pelt. So, the lead intruder felt the pelt, and indeed it was dry and crackly, and he let Kitulo go. "Let this be a warning to you all," he said. "Anyone caught killing a Taglusi capybara will be tried in Manaus and sent to prison, where they will rot and die." After the intruders left, Kitulo asked Olon what a prison was. Olon thought for a moment, then said, "A prison is a room with no windows." Kitulo then asked what a room was, and Olon responded by saying it was like a hut made out of rock with no entrance or exit. "But there's no such thing as a rock hut with no entrance," Kitulo said. "The Wazongo have created their world, and in it there are rock huts with no entrance and no exit," Olon responded. "What a strange world," responded Kitulo. "And what are such huts created for?" "They are created to confine those who commit the daka, the bad thing," answered Olon. "And what daka have we committed, Olon?" asked Kitulo. "You hunt the capybara," she responded. "But we have been hunting the capybara all our lives. What has changed?" he asked. "The Wazongo have killed off most of the capybara, and your world's capybara are the only ones that are left," she responded. "But what has that to do with us?" asked Kitulo. "The Wazongo say that they own the capybara, and that the capybara is for them, and not you," responded Olon. "But the capybara belongs to the jungle, our home, and not the Wazongo," he stated. "The Wazongo say they now possess the jungle and everything in it, and that they set the rules of what is daka and what isn't. And if we commit daka, they will put us in the stone hut with no entrance or no exit. But the jungle cannot be possessed, for it possesses all." "What kind of thinking is that? We are the jungle, and aren't the Wazongo part of the jungle too? Isn't that the way nature is?" responded Kitulo. "I know that sounds unthinkable, But the Wazongo think they can overcome nature, that they can create the way things should be, and destroy that which they do not believe in, she said. Next chapter. Title. 3 months passed and life went on as usual, with the tribe ignoring the intruders' warnings and hunting the capybara. But one day they sensed the presence of the intruders once again. Olon tried to have them hide the capybara hides and tails, but Kitulo told them to ignore the warnings and to live life and do things the way they have always done them. As two intruders walked into the camp, Olon tried to distract them by talking to them in their Wazongo language and greeting them. She asked them their names. Then they noticed the capybara pelts lying on the logs. "To whom does this pelt belong?" asked one of the intruders as he pointed to one of the pelts. Kitulo stood up and said it was his, so the intruder raised his rifle and shot Kitulo in the chest. "Let that be a lesson to you all," said the intruder, and the two of them left the camp. As Kitulo lay dying in his sister Belifto's arms, he whispered, "Don't let this sway you from carrying on our traditions and ways of life." He died later that evening as the tribe gathered around the fire pit for the night's activities. It was a night full of sorrow, and they acted out the ritual death scene skit, which consisted of placing the Batisto tree bark on Kitulo's chest and singing the death song, running into the shadows, hunting for the lost tribe. Running into the shadows, finding the mother of all tribes. The forest will rise if you love her. If you don't love her now, you will never be wise. So, rise to your feet and shout. If you don't love her now, no one will hear your cries. The forest will rise, and the forest will rise. The next morning, Olon approached the sister of Kitulo and said, "What the intruders did was wrong, and they should be punished." "But how are we going to punish them? They are gone," responded Belifto. "I know their names," said Olon, who continued and said that she will have to go to Manaus and report the death to the authorities, that she will take Kitulo's ID card as proof that he is a citizen of Brazil, wrongfully killed. Next chapter. Title. Manaus. 2 weeks later, Olon arrived in Manaus, looking for Alejandro for his help in prosecuting the intruder, Rodriguez Santos, for the murder of Kitulo, but she didn't find him. He had mentioned to her that he would stay, but when she went to the hotel he was staying in, she found out that he had left for Brasilia the week before. So Olon continued on to Brasilia. She checked into the Grand Green River Hotel and asked Juanita if Alejandro was residing there. Juanita said that he had left a forwarding address. Olon found Alejandro renting a villa on the outskirts of the city and told him what had happened. He was shocked to hear that Kitulo was no longer with them. He explained to Olon that it was a matter for the district attorney to prosecute Rodriguez Santos. So, they both proceeded to the courthouse the next day and reported the case to the police. And as they were filling out the information on the report form with the constable, he found out that it happened in the Brazilian jungle up north in the jurisdiction of Manaus, and told them that they would have to file the report there. After Alejandro packed his bag, they headed out to Manaus, arriving midday and going directly to the hotel they were in before. They reserved a room for the both of them. The next day, they went to the courthouse and reported the murder to the local police. When they told the police where the murder occurred, namely in the middle of the Amazon River basin, the policeman taking down the information scratched his head and said, "I'm sorry, senora, but we can't investigate this case." When she asked him why, he said that it was too far out in the jungle and they had no means or resources to go there. Olon asked the officer for his supervisor's name, and both she and Alejandro entered Major General Lucien's office, who asked them what their business was. Olon told him it was the murder of a Brazilian citizen by a representative of a non-governmental organization called the Capybara International Conservation Group. "I'm not the person to speak to. You should go downstairs and talk to the report officer," said the Major General. "We have already been down there, Major Gen, Lucien, and they would not help us. They told us to come to you. They said they didn't have the resources to investigate our case, since it is far out in the jungle of the Amazon River basin," Olon replied. The Major General asked them for the information on the case, and he wrote it down in his notebook, including Cthulhu's ID number.
I understand now why the people downstairs couldn't do it for you. I will have to go to a higher authority to acquire the resources to investigate this case.
The Major General picked up his phone and started talking to someone on the other end regarding their case. And after about 5 minutes of relaying the information from his notebook, he got the go-ahead to send Detective Layton. Olan thanked the Major General for his efforts, and they headed to the office, where they could find Detective Layton, where they all agreed to meet for a late lunch to discuss their plans. Detective Layton was a short, thin man of about 45 years of age, with slick black hair and a waxed mustache that was curled up at its ends and with eyebrows treated the same, turned up at the outside edges. His teeth were dark brown, for he was a chain smoker of those thin cigars that come in different flavors. He wore a pressed white shirt with a tie and a clean and sharp jacket. His trousers were of the striped type and in the same condition as his jacket. Lunch was at Bongo's Bar and Grill. The detective brought with him a notepad and pen. The detective complained to the waiter that there was not a formal set of silverware on the table, which was corrected. Olan and Alejandro had soup and a sandwich, while the detective had the filet mignon. After they had eaten, the detective brought out his notepad, and they started planning the trip. He wrote down the distances from place to place and estimated how long it was going to take to travel and do his work using a slide rule. He estimated that the whole project would take a week. When he presented this information to Olan and Alejandro, they gasped. They realized he underestimated how difficult the project was, and when they tried to correct him, he insisted that the slide rule does not lie. It was fruitless to argue with him, so they went along, and at the end of the meeting, they made plans of where to meet to start the journey to investigate the death of Cthulhu. The detective at the end stood up and shook their hands, thanking them for a great lunch, and that he looked forward to working with them. The three of them met the next morning at the bus station, where they got onto a bus that took them as close to the jungle as they could get. The detective traveled with a satchel and a rolled-up sleeping bag that he carried on his back. They traveled for half a day and then asked the driver to stop where they needed to get off. Alejandro stayed behind as Detective Layton and Olan made their way through the forest. Olan explained to the detective that it was best that he never come in contact with the tribe's people in order not to transfer to them any diseases that he might be carrying. She explained that she would do all the necessary work in defining the crime scene for his report. He didn't understand at first, but when she explained to him that the tribe's people have little resistance to civilized diseases and often die from simple infections such as the flu, he was agreeable to the conditions that she put on his participation as a detective in the jungle. They also agreed to make camp outside of the tribespeople's camping area. On the first day, they only made it into the forest about a mile. It was especially hard for the detective, for he lost his hat and his mustache ended up turned down instead of up. But he pretended like he had a good time, smiling as they went along building the campfire. Olan made her hut out of the local vegetation, and the detective rolled out his sleeping bag in the hut Olan made him next to the fire pit. Olan emerged the next day as a native devoid of attire, which was surprising to the detective, who blushed. He said that he didn't know she was one of the tribespeople she was defending. The detective had a small mirror with him, and he got busy fashioning his mustache and hair, which took about half an hour. They had a goal of covering 4 miles, so they started just as it started to become light after the detective combed his hair back and fixed up his eyebrows. During this hike, the detective lost his left shoe to the mud, and his jacket acquired a large rip from a thorny bush. On the way, they managed to pick some mushrooms, berries, and other vegetation that they could eat when they reached the camp area that day. By the end of the second day, Detective Layton had a hard time keeping a smile, and the wear and tear was starting to show in his attitude, like his bleeding toe that was sticking out of his left foot stocking. His pants now had large rips in them, and his jacket was now unrecognizable as such. and he took it off completely to augment the thin pillow attached to his sleeping bag.
"Eat," would say Olan several times to the detective, for he had a hard time swallowing the local cuisine. On the third morning, Olan gathered some nuts and berries for their breakfast, and the detective at this point dispensed with his mirror activities, for his groomed hair and mustache would be a mess by the time they were half an hour into their trek. He was getting used to how to avoid thorny bushes and mud puddles, and they thought that he made out better than the previous day. They made only 3 miles into the jungle on the third day, so they lowered their expectations and decided to try for 3 miles again on the fourth day. By the end of the day, the detective decided to make shorts out of his pants and take off his shirt, which now had one small rip. He was trying to save it by rolling it up into the sleeping bag. He had no difficulty eating that fourth night, for he was extremely hungry. Early that night, after he tucked himself into his sleeping bag in his hut next to the fire pit, and Olan in her hut, he asked her where she grew up. He noticed that she had a way about her that was Western and not native. She told him the story of how Maggie found her and took her in, and that she was brought up in a town called Eugene, Oregon. And he asked her where she lived now. Was it in Eugene, or was it in the jungle? She answered that she preferred the jungle. The next morning, Olan found a pool of water deep enough for them to bathe in, so she went over and woke up the detective and invited him to join her. He hesitated at first, but seeing that she was a native with no objections to his nude body, he hesitatingly agreed. It was a refreshing swim washing away 4 days' worth of smelly sweat and dirt. When they got back to camp and the detective could smell his rank clothing, he hesitated to put them back on and decided to hike that day like a native. Olan figured they had one more day to go before reaching the outskirts of her tribe's territory. They made good time that fifth day and managed to cover about 4 miles. So off they went, he with his hairy chest and back exposed to the elements. He didn't bother to mess with the mirror that morning and threw it away. On the sixth day of hiking, he had learned enough tricks and methods from Olan to get around and through the brush, and they made good time. That evening, they sat around the fire pit and talked about various aspects regarding the case. But then, he decided to change the subject and asked her why she preferred the jungle over civilized living. She said that she couldn't put her finger on why it is, but she had several theories, one of which was that she is from the jungle and had always wanted to return to it. She also mentioned that the living style is much simpler and less encumbered with all sorts of rules and laws that often do not make sense to her in the civilized world. She said, "The people of the jungle feel as if they are part of the jungle and not apart from it, like Westerners think or consider themselves. There's a sense of unity with one's environment that you give and you take in a very simple way. Everything is provided for in the jungle. We don't have to worry about going to work on a schedule, paying bills on a schedule, and eating on a schedule. Here in the jungle, if we want to eat, we pick off the trees whatever we need, and there's always something edible there. I know that in the civilized world, the jungle's lifestyle is portrayed as one of laziness, poverty, and hopelessness. But it really isn't. It is a carefree life. We don't worry where the next meal is going to come from, or where we are going to sleep at night, or who we are going to sleep with." At this point, they were inside the territory of the Bantulo tribespeople and could expect to see them at any time in their travels the next day. Olan thought of setting some rules to guard against contaminating their environment with diseases that the detective may be carrying. She decided that she would take the lead in their hiking, and he should stay about 10 yards behind her. That if she stops, he stops, and so on. They traveled another 4 miles into the jungle that sixth day and did not encounter anybody from the Bantulo tribe. But they did encounter a fresh fire pit that was perhaps a day or two old, and they knew that they were getting close. By this time, Detective Lawton had learned to pick some of his food from the environment he was in. The only thing that they did not do was hunt for fresh meat, for they had no nets and did not know how to fashion spears. That evening, while sitting around the fire pit, Olan asked Detective Layton why he preferred the civilized way of life over that of the jungle.
He said that he can't put a finger on it after thinking for a while, but perhaps it has to do with efficiency in everyday life and work. Something like doing more with less. For example, we have farmers who can produce large quantities of food on their own to feed many, many people, in addition to themselves. He went on to say, if someone gets sick, he or she goes to a doctor and gets well again. And so our life expectancy has been increasing. Not only that, but a single doctor can make hundreds of people well again. So, he thought he and others were right in their thinking that civilized people are more efficient in the civilized world, and that a single person can do good for many people. Olin said that it is true that farmers in the civilized world can produce more food than they need, and that doctors can make people healthy again in vast numbers. She went on to say that in the jungle, no one needs to produce more food than they can pick off the trees and hunt for in the forest, so there is no need for farmers, and that the forest provides all the food they need. As far as disease is concerned, the people of the forest live in very people-scarce surroundings and are not susceptible, therefore, to communicable diseases, so doctors are not needed. And if someone gets wounded or sick for whatever reason in the forest, there is an ample supply of flowers and trees that help with the healing process. After Olan's rebuttal, she went into her hut, the detective curled up in his sleeping bag in his hut, and they both went to sleep as the fire died down. In the middle of the night, the detective woke up from a dream about Olan, and he decided to accompany her in her hut that night. On the trek the next morning with Olan taking the lead, and the detective 10 yards behind, they were met by a hunting party from the Bantulo tribe. Olan was greeted with open arms and hugs, and she explained to them that they have a visitor that needs to be quarantined outside of to guard against diseases. She also instructed that the detective not approach anybody in the tribe, even if they tried to get close. After the greetings, Olan explained that she and the detective would be making their camp about 100 yards away from the tribespeople's camp, and that they should have contact only with her and not him. She explained that there was no danger from him physically, it was just that he may be carrying diseases that might harm them. She also explained to them that the detective was a representative from the government of Brazil, and that he would be asking questions regarding the death of Kitulo. That the questions would come from her only, and that they should not approach him with any of their answers, and to only give answers to her as a safeguard. The detective and Olan made their camp, and this time, Olan showed the detective how he could make his hut from the local surrounding vegetation. They then went out picking mushrooms, berries, and various nuts for their meal. When they got back to their camp, Olan walked over to the tribespeople's camp and asked if they could give them some meat. They obliged them with 2 capybara thighs hot and ready to go. Olan decided to stay in the detective's camp that night to keep him company. The conversation twirled around the longevity of people in the civilized world, as opposed to the longevity of people in the Amazon River basin, namely the natives. From her studies, Olan knew that civilized people live to about 70 or 80 years of age, while people in the jungle live to about 50. The detective used these figures to promote the advantage that civilized people have over that of people in the jungle. Olan had mixed feelings about this fact, and thought about it for a long time. Yes, tribespeople have a shorter lifespan, and she asked herself why that was, and if there was a reason for it. She didn't feel that the tribespeople considered their lifespan as a negative aspect of their life, for they were a happy bunch who felt sorrow when somebody died, just like the civilized people do. So why wasn't there a desire in the tribespeople to live longer? She asked herself. She advertised her thoughts and feelings about the subject to the detective in the conversation that evening around their fire pit. And he gloated that life must be better in the civilized world than it is in the tribespeople's world, and for that time of the evening, Olan had to agree. But why then wouldn't the tribespeople want to live longer was a question that remained in her mind. The next day, the detective retrieved a thick notebook from his satchel that he had prepared. In this notebook, the pages started with a large circle that he explained to Olan as a representative circle of the camp at the time of the incident. This page was followed by 26 pages. Each page had the name of each tribe member, and he gave her instructions on how to fill out each page. She was to place the position of each member of the tribe in the circle when the crime was committed. This was to be achieved by placing the ID number of the tribe member in the circle. Each one of the pages would have the name of the tribe member and a description of what they were doing and what they saw at the time the crime was committed. This was going to be done by an interview of each tribe member by Olan. This process could only be completed with each tribe member in the evening as they sat around the tribe's fire pit, and she was able to complete on average about 2 tribe members an evening. Since the tribe members did not speak Portuguese, she had to translate from the Bantulo dialect to Portuguese. The whole process took about 15 days to complete. The next task was for the detective to measure where each person was in the camp concerning where the crime was committed. And to his disappointment, he found out that they had moved away from the campsite where the crime was committed. The crime scene was about a day's hike away, so they gathered up their belongings, traveled about 3 miles to the west, and started looking for that camp's fire pit. They could not find it at first, but the next day they found it about 600 yards from where they were camped. Positions of the huts could be made out around the fire pit, and the position of each person in the camp was approximated. The detective put markers where they were standing based on the circular diagram he had made up previously. He then took out from his satchel a large spool of measuring tape and measured the distance between each person and the crime scene. He also needed to know where the intruders were standing with respect to the deceased. He then turned his attention to try to find the location where the body was buried. It was marked on the circular map, but the location was all overgrown, and they had to use a machete to clear it and a shovel to dig. He was told that it was a shallow grave, and eventually, by the end of the day, they found a skull and presumed that it was of the deceased. He took pictures of it with his cell phone. He was able to complete what he needed to do by the evening of the second day, while Olan collected their food and managed to spear and kill a capybara. That evening, when they bedded down around the fire pit, Olan told the detective that she wondered why the tribespeople didn't live longer than the Wazongos. She explained that both the tribespeople and the Wazongos are the same genetically, and so if the Wazongos have the desire to live longer, why didn't the tribespeople? The detective countered by saying that the Wazongos, or the civilized people, are smarter than the tribal people. Olan took issue with that in saying they are genetically identical. Therefore, the tribespeople should be just as smart as the Wazongos. She went on to say that the only difference is the Wazongos think they are smart or smarter than anything else on Earth, while the tribespeople do not. She continued by saying that the tribespeople think that everything is inherently smart. The detective agreed that the civilized people think they are smarter than the tribal people, and as evidence, the way that the tribal people live in dirt, mud, and vegetation, while the civilized people live in houses with toilets and refrigerators. He went on to say that civilized people know that they are smarter than everything else on the planet, and that they have the smarts to do anything they want. Olan argued that civilized people live in a manner that cannot be sustained on Earth for long, that it is a foreign way of life never meant for this planet we call Earth. It took 4 billion years for the tribespeople to live the way they do. They are dependent on natural factors to secure a livelihood that is well suited to them. She went on to say living in dirt, mud, and vegetation is the most natural way that man should live, to safeguard the planet from what is happening to it right now. The detective had nothing to say at that point, and they both drifted off into sleep. The next morning, after they had a few berries to eat, the detective wanted to head back to the main camp where the tribal people were, while Olan thought that they should hike out to Manaus and get busy with the trial. The detective insisted on going back to the tribal people. He said that he needed to get more information and also to bring back with him a couple of people to be witnesses. "What information do you need from the tribal people?" asked Olan. He said that he didn't know exactly, but he just wanted to go over what he had written down so far. I advise against taking anybody from the tribe to Manaus, for they will surely die. It will be a death sentence for them, she argued. They argued back and forth over this point for several minutes until the detective said, All right, we will head back to Manaus right now. It was a 4-day journey from where they were. During daylight, they hunted for food and traveled as far as they could before bedding down. The conversation continued in the evenings on whether tribal people were smarter or the Wazongos were smarter, as the detective put it. The label smarter ticked off Olon, who considered that it was a label for the Wazongos to distance themselves from the rest of the living. That it was unfair and untrue. She refrained from using the term, and she argued that the detective should refrain from using the term as well, because it didn't help matters. Olon stressed the point that the tribal people came as a result of 4 billion years of trial and error, and they have established a way of life that not only protects the earth, but allows them to live in harmony with it. She used a stick to draw the earth on the ground, and the sun next to it, with arrows pointing from the sun to the earth, representing the sun's energy transfer. She said that that was all that was required to live on, earth and sun. That all the living were powered by the sun, and that is the way it should be. But the detective countered by saying that fossil fuels were developed by the sun and living matter, and that it's only natural for humans to utilize this resource to make living conditions better for themselves. Olon argued that the fossil fuels are going to run out in a few hundred years, and asked, Then what are you going to do? The detective answered that question by saying, Civilized man will then use solar power to fuel his lifestyle. Olon went on to say that this lifestyle requires more than solar energy. It requires resources such as water, metals, minerals, and vegetation to continue. She went on to say that these metals and minerals will eventually run out, and by that time the earth would have been destroyed in a matter of 500 years or less. Then what are Wazongos going to do? Will there be anything left for you or the tribespeople worth living for? She asked. They came out of the jungle, not far from where they left. Alejandro and all three proceeded to head to Manaus using bus and cab services. Next chapter. Title. Trial number 2. When all three arrived in Manaus, the detective returned to his home while Olon and Alejandro checked into their hotel room. Waiting for Olon was a court summons. She and the Bantulo tribe were being sued by the Capybara International Conservation Group for poaching the Taglusi capybara. On what basis do they sue you? Commented Alejandro as he was reading the summons document. I suppose the two intruders who killed Cthulhu reported back to the organization that the tribe was still hunting the capybara, answered Olon. Yes, it says right here that Alberto Benito, who was probably one of the goons that killed Cthulhu, reported that they found numerous fresh capybara skins in the Bantulo tribe's camp, said Alejandro. What do you think I should do? Asked Olon. Now I have two trials on my hands. I hope you can help me. The summons says that the poaching trial starts in 3 weeks. I don't suppose the murder trial here will start any sooner. It will probably be a couple months before the territorial attorney can start proceedings, responded Alejandro. That should give us enough time to tackle this poaching trial. Olon called Maggie and told her what was going on and requested more funds for the Capybara International Conservation Group's problem. Both Olon and Alejandro packed their bags and headed to Brasilia, where they checked into the Grand Green River Hotel and started work on defending the tribe against the accusation of poaching. Olon wrote down the defense of the tribe in their need to hunt and eat the capybara. It stated pretty much what the first trial was all about, namely that the Bantulo tribe was helping the capybara survive by harvesting the old and sick animals, and therefore keeping a healthy and thriving population in the jungle that they occupied. Alejandro thought about this approach for a day and came back to Olon, arguing that they tried that approach before, but it failed, and the chances were high that it would fail again. What do you propose, Alejandro? Asked Olon. I don't know, but what I do know is that it's fruitless to take the angle of ecology into the argument because few people really understand what ecology is all about. It is a complex science, and I think that is why we failed in our previous court case, said Alejandro. He then said, But I have an idea. Let's take the definition of poaching and try to use it in a way that shows that the Bantulo tribe cannot be defined as poachers. He told Olan to come with him to the local library and look up the legal definition of poaching. At the library, Alejandro used the Google search engine to look up poaching, and it turned to the definition that signifies cooking an egg in a particular way. Well, that didn't work for them, so they had to look somewhere else. One of the entries on Google defined it as the illegal hunting or capturing of wild animals, usually associated with land use rights. According to this definition, we have two lines of attack. One, we can pursue the legal aspect of your tribe's rights. The other line of attack would be the land use aspect, said Alejandro. I understand the first line of attack and that the tribe has the legal right to hunt the capybara, but I don't follow the second line of attack, which is the land use aspect, Olan said. Alejandro went on to say that in both lines of attack, the wording of the previous court case refraining the tribe from hunting the capybara never brought it up as being illegal if done by the tribal members, so it's a technical approach. In the second case of land use, nowhere in the previous court case does the wording land use ever come up, nor was it specified in the final verdict. Again, this is a technical tactic, and he thought they should pursue them both in the next trial. But Olan argued that the court would see right through the technical terms and side with the Capybara International Conservation Group based on intent. Alejandro countered by saying, It will cause the third trial to be set up to decide whether these terms are to be included in the final verdict or not, and we will have to worry about that later if ever a third trial comes up. While Alejandro was doing his research, Olan wrote a paper entitled Don't Mess with Mother Nature. It was about the influence of natural events in shaping the human condition. She submitted it to the New Biological Offset Journal. Alejandro felt confident in his approach in the trial, but Olan was a little uneasy. She felt that they probably would not get the same judgment, and therefore the ecological approach would be better. But she resigned to the fact that Alejandro knew more about court proceedings and logic than she did, so she took a back seat and let him steer the boat. The presiding judge in this second trial, whose name was Agostino Rafael, was known to be very strict and to the letter of the law, as Alejandro found out, and this would help their cause in the technical aspects of the case. Judge Agostino was from the farming community, and his destiny was to take over his father's position as owner of the Rafael Ranch Empire. But an accident ripped his right arm off while running a combine, and he decided to get into a profession less demanding. On the appointed day and after introductions, the judge asked the Capybara International Conservation Group to give their opening statement. Thank you, Your Honor, was the opening statement by Eduardo Domingo, the conservation group lawyer who went on to say, The territory that the tribe occupies is territory that is owned by the Capybara International Conservation Group for the purpose of protecting the Taglusi capybara. This protection includes the refrain from hunting of the capybara. We will present proof that the Bantulo tribe has been hunting the capybara in our territory. Judge Agostinho then asked Alejandro to present the defendant's opening statement. Thank you, Your Honor, Alejandro said and went on to say, First, there are no federal or local laws against the hunting of the Taglusi capybara in the said territory by the Bantulo tribe or any other individual. Second, there are no federal rules regarding the land use of the territory. To clarify, I will read the text of the ruling in the court case that decided the fates of the tribe and Taglusi capybara. The Capybara International Conservation Group is the guardian of the Taglusi capybara, and that all people, including the Bantulo tribe's people, are to refrain from hunting it. Nowhere in the text of the ruling does it spell out that the hunting of the Taglusi capybara is illegal, nor is there mention that it is illegal to use the land of the territory in any different way than it has been used for centuries. Judge Agostinho asked what court decided the tribal people should refrain from hunting the Taglusi capybara. Alejandro said that it was a civil court case. The judge then said the ruling has no standing within the legal system of Brazil. that it is a lower court decision to settle an argument between two contestants that has nothing to do with the Brazilian governess. He continued to say that no laws were broken in this case, either in the hunting of the capybara or the use of the land as a hunting ground for the capybara. He then ruled against the Capybara International Conservation Group. The judge went on to say that the tribe could continue to hunt the capybara. After this victory, Olon and Alejandro departed for Manaus the next day. They arrived a day later and went to work on the third trial, namely the murder of Catulo. When they arrived at the courthouse, they could not locate Detective Latin and were told that he was on vacation for a few days. When he still didn't show up, they went to his manager and asked where they could locate him. The manager was hesitant for a while, and after continued inquiries by Olon and Alejandro, he agreed to give them the detective's home telephone number. "Hello, Senora Latin. I would like to speak to Senor Latin, please," requested Olon. "Senor Latin has left," responded the senora. "Where did he go, may I ask?" asked Olon. "I don't know," the senora responded in distress. Olon managed to get Signora Latin's address, and both she and Alejandro proceeded to the address to speak with her in person. When she opened the door, tears were streaming down her cheeks as she asked them in. "What happened, Signora?" asked Olon. "I don't know. He started acting very strange." "What was he doing to make you think he was acting strangely?" asked Olon. "He started sleeping in the backyard, and after a while, before he went to sleep, he would build a campfire and do strange acts around it." "Can you describe these acts, Signora?" "The first night he built a campfire, took off all his clothes, and started singing this strange song that sounded like a bird singing. A few days later, he started sounding like a monkey with hoots like monkeys do at the zoo. On another night, he climbed the fig tree. All this before he went to sleep. He became like an animal, for he didn't shave nor fashion his mustache like he used to do. The neighbors were starting to get upset from all the noise he was making, to say nothing of his nakedness." "I understand, Signora, but do you know where he went to?" asked Olon. "I don't know. He just took off naked down the street, and I never saw him again." "How long ago was that, Signora?" asked Olon. "2 days ago." That evening, Alejandro asked Olon why the detective went crazy like that, and she answered that he did not go crazy. She said that he was dancing the Bungoli dance and singing the love song of the first human beings in the world of the Bantulo tribespeople. She went on to say that the bird represented the female, and the male was represented by the monkey who climbed to the heavens to bring her down to earth. He learned of this story from her, for she relayed it to him as they were watching from his camp the events unfolding at night in the Bantulo tribe, people's camp, 100 yards away. "So where do you think the detective left to?" asked Alejandro. "He is on his way to the Bantulo tribe," she responded. "Isn't that dangerous for the tribe?" asked Alejandro. "Yes, it is. But it's more dangerous for the detective. He never cared to learn how to hunt for food in the jungle, nor travel in it properly." "What do you mean by that?" asked Alejandro. "His fate is sealed. He will never make it to the tribe," Olon responded. Realizing that the murder trial was in jeopardy, they proceeded to the courthouse and the office of Major Gen Lucien. "Good morning, Gen Lucien," said Olon as she entered his office. "It is my understanding that Detective Latin is not returning." "What gave you that idea?" asked the Major General. "We just came back from his home, and his wife tells us that he is gone and to not expect him back," said Olon. "He took off into the jungle, and we don't expect him to survive. Is there someone else who can take over for him?" "I am afraid not. Detective Latin was an indispensable asset to us, and his loss means a great deal, but I cannot justify pursuing your case any further," said the Major General. Feeling defeated in pursuing justice for the murder of Catulo, Olon started her journey back to her tribe the next day, and Alejandro returned to Brasilia. Next chapter. Title: The Eviction. Olon didn't return empty-handed, for she was able to get the authorities to decide that it was okay to hunt the capybara, which was a great relief to the tribe. They didn't have to look over their shoulders when they went hunting for it. Getul, the sister of slain Catulo, became a close friend of Olon. Getul had a million questions for Olon when she came back from Manaus with news of the failed attempts to prosecute the intruders for the murder of Catulo. It meant a great deal to her that Olon made the seemingly impossible effort. It was approximately 2.5 years after the return of Olon that an alarming word came that the intruders were back one afternoon while the tribe prepared the daily meal. It was Alodi's turn to be lookout, and he came back with word that the intruders were carrying fire sticks and whips. Olon was perplexed, for she thought that they had the go-ahead to hunt the capybara, and she didn't know why the intruders were there. Getul was not surprised, for the intruders were murderers, and they had no reason to be there except to cause more harm. So, she sounded the alarm, and the men took up any weapons they could, such as their bows and arrows or spears ready for confrontation. Three intruders walked into the camp and started yelling in Portuguese that the tribespeople were breaking the law by killing the capybara. Olon yelled back by saying that the courts decided that they could hunt the capybara for meat and hide. The lead intruder walked up to Olon, grabbed her wrist, holding it up, and said that it is now Brazilian law that hunting the Taglusi capybara was illegal. Olon argued to the contrary. "There is no such law," she said. The intruder, while holding her wrist, let it go, dug into his satchel, and brought out a paper with writing on it, and pointed out a paragraph where it said that hunting of the Taglusi capybara was illegal in Brazil. He then proceeded to say that the whole tribe was in conflict with the law, and that he had the right to gather them all and take them to Manaus to be prosecuted. Olon turned to the tribespeople and explained what the intruder had said and showed her. The intruder then said that there was an alternative path they could take, and that was to leave the Capybara International Conservation Group's territory, make a new home in the mountains to the south, and no harm would come to them. When Olon translated this to the tribe, there was an uproar. They didn't want to move. Getul said that the mountains were barren, with not enough food to feed them all. After thinking for a few seconds, Olon requested that they have a day to decide. The intruder said that was okay, and they will return the next day. They then left the camp area. When Olon explained to the tribe what they needed to do before the next day, the men chanted the war song, making the decision very clear. They will stay, and they will fight for their land and their capybara. That night was a very long one. Olon was saddened by her defeat in the courts with the success of the conservation group's efforts to get the law on the books. But all that was swept away in her mind with the thoughts of the impending battle the next day. When the intruders entered the camp the next afternoon, they noticed that there were no men around, and before they could react, one of them was shot with an arrow in the neck. The two other intruders picked him up and retreated into the jungle. Thinking that they had won the battle, the tribesmen reappeared and started chanting the victory song, with the women and children joining them. The next afternoon, Alodi, the lookout, came running into camp, yelling that two intruders were coming back. The men gathered their spears, arrows, and bows and rushed into the bush. When the intruders arrived, they started whipping the women and children, who then fled in the direction of the mountains. Arrows and spears started to fall on the intruders, and they answered back with their guns, killing two men and wounding another. The remaining five tribesmen fled. They didn't have a chance against the fire sticks and decided to catch up with the women and children towards the mountains. Behind them, the intruders fired their guns and chased after them until they made sure that the message got through to the tribe that they were not to stay in that territory any longer. It took the tribe approximately 2 exhausting weeks to reach the foothills of the mountains to the south. Getul looked up towards the mountains and said, "There is no livelihood for us up there." Olon tried to look on the bright side and suggested that there are other game to be hunted and trapped up there. Getul responded by saying that the trees are scarce and therefore the game would be scarce. The sun is too hot and they would not find mushrooms. It was a somber mood that evening around the campfire. Some were crying for those who died. Some were thinking about how they were going to make it up there and live in the mountains. As the embers started to die, the inevitable thoughts of dispersion started to sink in. In the morning, Getul made the final decision, They were all to be dispersed in different directions and hopefully meet up with tribes that would accept them. Children started crying, then mothers started crying, and men were moaning. For they lived together for such a long time and had been through a lot just to be cast into the wind. Getul decided that adults should go in twos. That way they could hunt and gather food more efficiently for themselves and their children until they found a new tribe. Then it came time for Getul to leave, and she was the one person that was left alone. Olon was assumed to be returning to civilization with her son Olongo and daughter Olongi, but she decided not to, and so she and Getul teamed up together and headed east. They traveled in that direction for about 10 days, when they started to see evidence in the forest of human activity. They then decided to stay where they were in anticipation of being discovered. About 2 days later, a group of tribesmen entered their camp. Getul had instructed Olon's children on what to do when that happens, so they all prostrated themselves on their backs and allowed the tribesmen to look and feel them over. The lead tribesman asked them where they were from, and Getul responded by saying that they were from the Bantulo tribe that had been disbanded by the Wazongos. Then the lead tribesman asked what a Wazongo was exactly. She said that it was a white-faced man who carried a fire stick, that three of them killed three of their tribesmen. She went on to say that Wazongos were from the land of the Shaitan of Dark Powers. "How far away are these Wazongos of the land of the Shaitan?" asked the lead tribesman. She answered, "There should be many more than 10 falling shadows away." The lead tribesman then asked them why they were there, and she responded by saying that her tribe had to disperse, and Olon, her children, and herself were seeking refuge in another tribe. They requested that they be taken in by them. The tribesmen got together in a circle and started discussing the matter, and after a few moments, the lead tribesman approached Getul and told her that they could only take one woman. He pointed to Olon as the one they wanted, since she was the younger one. Getul looked at Olon and told her to go with them, and that she and the children would find their way to another tribe. But all knew she and Olon's children would not survive. Olon then looked at Getul and told her to go with the tribesmen, for she would head back to Brasilia with her children. She then looked at the lead tribesman and asked him to take Getul instead, and he agreed. With that, Getul and the tribesmen left, leaving Olon behind with her children to find their way back to civilization. Next chapter. Title: Brasilia. At the Grand Green River Hotel, Olon asked the clerk, Juanita, for a larger room to accommodate all three of them. After the three of them settled in, she phoned Alejandro, who told her he tried to contact her, but didn't know how to get to her in the jungle, to warn her of the new law against hunting of the capybara. For a few days, Olon would sit on her balcony, watching the sunset, thinking of what to do next, or where to go on the next leg of her life's journey. She tried to put into perspective all that had happened to her and her tribe in the last few years. She thought about the future of her children. She was torn between returning to the jungle and somehow making it with her children, or returning to civilization and fighting for the rights of her people. She felt something was missing in her thoughts. She started thinking about her belief system and if that would guide her. She wrote an essay entitled Acceptance that dealt with her belief system and how it guided her through her life so far. But after writing the essay, she felt that there was still something missing. So she called Maggie and asked her what she should do now that she was nowhere. Maggie told her to return to Eugene, Oregon, and get her doctorate from the University of Oregon. After the conversation with Maggie, Olon realized that Maggie's lost daughter, Nasmina, was what was missing in the story of Olon. So she decided to search for Nasmina and bring closure to her story and the story of Maggie. But where would she start? She asked herself. She then called Alejandro and asked him to meet her at the Excelsior coffee shop, not too far from the hotel, for lunch the next day. Juan, the waiter, served them each 2 poached eggs and a side of toast, as Olon was telling the story of Maggie and her loss of her daughter Nasmina. She held Olongi on her lap, and Olongo was playing with a spinning wheel. She said that Maggie was a woman who journeyed from being comfortable with her modern way of life to one who felt she needed to throw it all away and disappear into the jungles of the Amazon River Basin to live among its indigenous tribes. Olan went on and said Maggie had help in her trek from Alex, who was a Greek student at the Cairo American University in Egypt. Unfortunately, the powers that be dispensed with Alex and his radical ideas of nature versus capitalism leave Maggie with a boy child. On one of her trips to Argentina, the plane crashed in the Amazon jungle, and she lost her boy child, whom she had named Alex Jr. 10 years later, she embarked on a journey to find Alex Jr., whom she felt was still alive, and she found him among the natives. After a year of living with him in the jungle of the Amazon, she managed to take Alex Jr. back to the USA. Unfortunately, civilization rejected him and he died. She felt that modern life was too complicated and was drawn to the simpler life of a native Amazonian woman. She returned to the jungle and gave birth to a little girl named Nasmina, whom she lost after the forest was cleared by loggers. As Alejandro was paying Juan for lunch, Juan said that he overheard them talking about someone named Nasmina and said that he knew of a Nasmina who worked at the Grand Green River Hotel. Olan was then rendered speechless. Alejandro asked him if he could take them to the Nasmina at the hotel, and Juan agreed after he finished his shift at 8 o'clock that evening. They agreed to meet in the lobby of the hotel at 8:30 p.m. Olan sat on her balcony, not believing that she would meet Nasmina that evening. She couldn't believe how happy Maggie would be to find out that her daughter had been found. She realized that the chances of the name Nasmina appearing in that part of the country were so rare that this Nasmina must be Maggie's daughter. She thought of calling Maggie and telling her the news, but then she decided against it in case the person they meet turns out to be someone else. She couldn't help but feel proud of finding Nasmina after all these years, that it would be the greatest gift she could give Maggie, who suffered so much. That it would be partial payment of a debt she owed Maggie for finding her and taking her in. At the appointed hour, they met Juan in the hotel lobby, and he took them to the check-in desk and asked for Juanita. But the clerk said she went home about an hour prior. Juan asked him to call her and ask her to come to the lobby, for there was somebody who wanted to meet her. An hour later, Juanita entered the lobby and went straight to Juan and asked him what was going on. "Juanita, what is your birth name?" he asked her. "It is Nasmina," she responded. He then introduced her to Alejandro and Olan, who asked her, "Do you remember the name of your mother, Juanita?" "It is Margarita," she replied. "Why do you ask?" "My mother had a girl child named Nasmina that she lost about 21 years ago," responded Olan. "What is your mother's name?" asked Juanita of Olan. "It is Maggie," responded Olan. Tears started to roll down Juanita's cheeks. She then lifted her hands, covered her face, and started wailing uncontrollably. She then dropped to her knees, sobbing. Olan tried to console her to no avail. After about a minute, she regained control and her composure. She stood up and said, "My birth mother's name was Maggie, and I miss her so, so much." The end. Copyright 2019 by Hassan A. Rashid, all rights reserved. No part of this book may be reproduced or transmitted in any form by any means, graphic, electronic, or mechanical, including photocopying, recording, taping, or by any information storage retrieval system, without the written permission of the author. Contact ostamed@yahoo.com, ISBN 978-0-359-704-798, published in the United States of America by Hassan Rashid.